Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
Hi, everybody. I'm Pete. I'm a recovered alcoholic. Chris will be alive and sober and at a sacred place called Alcoholics Anonymous. And first things first, thank the group and Derek for this invitation to me to share tonight my experience, strength, and hope on steps 1 through 7. I've learned many, many times by doing this, regardless of what I've done the day before, the week before, when invitations like this are extended to me, it simply shows that God has spoke to a group conscience and your spirit has extended an invitation to mine. And when that stuff happens, we commence shoulder to shoulder upon a common journey. And when we follow a few simple rules laid out in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, not contemporary AA, but Alcoholics Anonymous big book, when we follow a few of those simple rules, we can get rocketed, catapulted to a place called the sunlight of the spirit, or very simply a word called bliss. So I thank you for this invite for me to be here and share about steps 1 through 7, and I'll come at you experientially about 1 through 7, not about what I think or feel or my opinion on it, because that's useless to an alcoholic who needs a solution, and it's useless to people who want to talk about the solution. It's kind of like getting in a car and going to a meeting and talking about the 9-step, what you would do if I was in the 9-step. I don't want to know about that. I want to hear from someone who's done the 9-step, who can teach me how to do it, what their experience were like. We can be around here a while and acquire a lot of knowledge. If we work with this book, with the sponsor, we'll acquire knowledge. I mean, how could you not, sitting down doing assignments out of the big book? But I can't say this enough to encourage you to bypass the knowledge and just seek experience. The knowledge you'll acquire, but we need to be really careful, because the very things that take me to God can be the very things that block me from God. And it's called worshiping intellect, worshiping the knowledge, worshiping the methodology in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's a subtle shift that happens, and it boomerangs on us, because we go from having all this information and having a little bit of an experience to forget the experience, I feel good, and I know what I need to do. And we throw sound bites out in the back of the room and tell the newcomers, well, read page 24 or read page, 44 or something like that. And we fall in love with our own intellect. But when we go home and hit the pillow, we wonder why we're really living on page 52. And not experiencing what the promises talk about in steps 10 and 11. Now, contemporary AA will tell you right up front, if as long as you put the plug in a jug and don't drink and go to meetings, as long as you're sober, you're a winner. And I'll argue with that. I'll challenge that with any real alcoholic. Because putting the drink down is just the beginning of this. I mean, I put the drink down because I was locked up in jail a few times. It had nothing to do with being a recovered alcoholic. It had very little to do with being on this path. It just meant I was taken away from my medicine for a little while. So again, seek experience. If you're new and you're just starting out on this path, you don't need to seek for belief. You don't need to seek for faith. Seek experience and you will take care of your faith and belief. And if you're on this path a little while, wondering why, wherever I go, there I am, and it's unmanageable. I'm living on page 52 and I can't get away from it. I'm hitting a wall. I'm flatlining in Alcoholics Anonymous. Try reworking the first 9 proposals and seeking experience, and you'll know if it's ego that's keeping you sick, because as soon as someone says, hey, I need to go through the first 9 proposals, I'm not ready to do that. I'll stay here sick. I'll be restless, irritable, and discontented, put on my AA game face, and the solution's offered to me, revisit the first 9 proposals, and I say, no, I'm not ready to do that yet. Ego. Maybe pride. No one should see me going through the work again. And as my sponsor put out to me one time, he said, did you eat today? And I said, yeah. He says, why? You ate yesterday. And then he pressed me. He says, what would happen? I said, well, I would get hungry. And then what? I'd probably get frail and sick and then eventually die. He says, right. So you eat regularly. Well, what about nourishment for the soul? What about nurturing the spirit? What about growing in understanding and effectiveness? What about seeking this power? We forgot that. So I need to continually rework the steps. I get through the first nine proposals, and the power I get in 10 or 11 will make me move, will allow me to move through the first nine again and again and again. And I continually smash ego. I continually kill self, all the manifestations of self. It's about growing up spiritually. If we're new in here for the first time, you know, you're kind of being led around by the sponsor. What do I do now? Okay, third step. Okay, fourth step. What do I do now? And then we have an experience. But that's not the beginning and end of it all. Because alcoholism is not done with me. And the sharper I get, the more awake I get in here, my illness gets just as sharp and looks for a crack in the armor. Well, we can't get him or her on booze, but we can work on the relationship angle. Where is he or she unmanageable? The financial angle. The sex. The food. Whatever it may be. So I continually go through the steps. We ought to continually go through these steps and kill manifestations of self. Successful living, daily dying. And we have to have God's help. And our book is being really mild and really gentle when they say we have to have God's help. We need God, period. I turn to God no longer for help. Because for me, I hear, I have it, I just need a little push. But I must turn all things into the Father of life besides of us. Oh, my book tells me that. God is everything or nothing. So I turn everything to God. Don't ask for his help. I beg him to show me. And he always does. And it's on his calendar. God separated me from alcohol June 23rd, 1980. I'm a recovered alcoholic. And I don't say that to boast, because if I didn't say it, I'd be falsely humble. If I didn't say I was a recovered alcoholic, I'd also be lying to another alcoholic. And the power I've been able to access in Alcoholics Anonymous by going through this work, by living in all three sides of the triangle, it has brought me to a place of being a recovered alcoholic, which is the first promise on the title page of the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I've had people walk out on me in AA meetings. They didn't like the idea that I brought a big book into an AA meeting. Which is like if you belong to a religious community and breathe, like I'm a Catholic, if I brought the Bible into church, the priest would say, what are you bringing that thing in here for? What happens in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, if you take some experience that you want to share out of the big book or bring the book in there, you know, 20 people walk out. And I've had people walk out on me in the middle of a talk when I said I'm recovered, because what they heard was cured. And if I can't love them, I bless them, because they don't know what they're talking about. They're just simply uninformed, and my job is to stand on the firing line and inform that I'm not cured, just recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body, which is a long way from where I left off in 1988 in the back of a hallway, June 23rd, where the obsession to drink alcohol was on me as long as I was awake. The phenomenon called craving was on me as long as I was drinking. And then it got to a place where I had to drink regardless of whether I wanted to or not, because I would become violently ill. And I don't give that lip service. I would get really ill if I didn't drink. Shaking was the easy part. The other stuff was worse. And so I make a sincere plea to this God, if you're out there. And I was one of those guys who bristled with antagonism when you talked about God. I wasn't too thrilled about hearing about this power called God. Because I used my thinking mind to sum up what God should have done. And he didn't. So therefore God was cruel and evil. But then we get to a place of incomprehensible demoralization, and suddenly we turn to anything that would work. And I always have turned back to this power, even in here sober, when I was angry with him, when I thought this power wasn't following the script that I wrote. When I was faced with unemployment and incredibly challenging financial times, divorce, losing a house, argue, bargain, get angry with God, try to make a deal with God. I'm not praying to you anymore. Then I turn back. Father, please show me what to do. But I'm a recovered alcoholic. And I'm very grateful for that. And if you knew me when I was drinking, you'd be grateful too. Trust me. My home group was a Vision for You group. We meet in Union, New Jersey. Which traffic is about 2 hours from here. MapQuest told me 26 minutes. Yes. So I'm going to call up the head MapQuest guy, and then I'll have to write inventory tonight. We're in Union, New Jersey. We meet tonight at 7:30 to 8:45. And we're a group that talks about the solution experientially from the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you want a solution, how to recover, you can visit our group. And somewhere within that hour, you'll have an awful lot of information on what to go home with, what to do in order to recover, who to look for, sponsorship. We have traditions meeting, a quarterly traditions meeting. And I will tell you, most people in Union, New Jersey don't like us. They hate us. They have names for us. That group, those people, don't go there. Then they hit a bottom, and they trickle into a Vision for You group, looking for a solution. And the members who are on this path do not say, I've never heard it, nor have I ever seen it, say, those are the non-big book people, the heck with them. We stand at the door ready. So we can show them a path to get free. Bill said something like, AA will destroy itself from within, not from without. You know what's happening in a lot of AA? It's the big book dumpers against the non-big book people. Those people, it's us and them. And what's really sad is the people who are claiming this book with their lips who are doing it. See, if someone's never walked through the big book and never had an experience with the work and never experienced the sunlight of the spirit, is not really free but is in AA untreated, what do I expect? If they look at the steps and say, stay away from that. If they see someone with a big book and say, stay away from them. What would I expect? Someone who may be untreated. Let me be a teacher. But how sad is it when people who have this book and have had an experience and get back to worshiping intellect and their emotions and their thinking mind stand at the door and say, those are the non-big book people. Those are the don't drink, go to meetings people. Stay away from them. Challenge that. Challenge what they do in those groups. Challenge what they're putting out there. Challenge 90 meetings in 90 days. Challenge put the plug in a jug. We ought to, because it's bad information. But let me never, ever character assassinate the person. And that's what happens. And we become just as dangerous with this book as the person who's saying to the real alcoholic, just put the plug in the jug. Because if God showed up, he wouldn't want any of that stuff. Those of us who had an experience, go stand at the door and wait for a new person. And that's what we try to do at a Vision for You group. So when they bottom out, they come looking for us, and when they're really even more desperate than that, some of them ask me to sponsor them. And then they find out what any lens looks like, and they're not so sure anymore. My first home group was a group called the Free Spirit Group. Over in Bensonhurst, Brooklyn. I was a member there for a good part of my sobriety. And we were up against it many times with this book and this information. A lot of contemporary don't you go to meetings in that area. And there was another group, they weren't too thrilled about hearing us coming in to give a talk. But I learned great lessons there. And I met great people, giants in Alcoholics Anonymous, great teachers, and one particular gentleman who walked me through this book. And then I found out a hard way, in a very challenging way, that if my teacher isn't growing in understanding and effectiveness, I can outgrow my teacher or my sponsor. And that was a tough one for me to come to terms with. Like, I felt disloyal, ungrateful to go out and seek a new teacher. But I was brought to a crossroads. And a new gentleman was put in my life. I prayed, Father, I need a new teacher. What do I do? And my current sponsor, Mark H., was put in my path, and that's the last 4 years about with this gentleman. And my life has been recreated many, many times for revisiting this work and incorporating a lot of other material along with, not instead of. I've been quick to see where religious people are at and make use of what they offer. I've gotten into many, many inspirational books and sought experience with all of it. But not being attached to, although I was a few times, not being attached to the outcome, or what I think the journey ought to look like. Because what we'll simply do then is just reinvent ourselves. We'll go right back to inquiring knowledge. Well, I think my spiritual experience should look this way. Or when I read some other inspirational books, I think I should be this way. Just be with it and let the work take you. Let God take you, rather than holding on to what I think the experience should look like. So before we get into this work, a couple of considerations that we have to take a look at. Is my recovery based in abstinence, or is my recovery based in spirit? See, if my recovery is based in abstinence, then I can simply be one of those people, and this is fine if this works for you, if this gets you through tonight, but I could not drink, go to meetings, put the plug in a jug, may still have power, choice, and control, and none of the work, some of the many lengths that we have to go through, really applies. My recovery is based in abstinence. It's all I care about. It doesn't interest me to examine what type of person I be in all my affairs. I don't care about making amends. It's their fault. I just didn't pick up today, and that's all I care about. And we have that because you'll hear some members say, I'm not drinking, that's amends for everybody. That's enough amends. That's amends to everybody. I didn't pick up the drink today. Or is my recovery based in spirit, which this work is aimed at? This work is aimed at spirit, not the thinking mind where the main problem for me lies. It's aimed at spirit. If my recovery is based in spirit, then I may be one of those people who's suffering from an illness which only a spiritual experience would conquer, which means I have to be one of those guys or some of our women who have to go to some of the many lengths in order to get recovered. And some of the many lengths is the third step decision. Well, am I willing to live on terms other than my own? And then going through a fourth step inventory, a thorough fourth step inventory, looking at me for the first time and not holding up a mirror to you anymore. And some of the considerations our book gives us. Is my recovery based in abstinence and spirit? Trust me, if it's based in abstinence, you can't wait till I am out of here. We're faced with, excuse me, spiritual life or spiritual death. Spiritual death for me, if I don't have this spiritual revolution, if I don't have this spiritual experience, if I'm not reintegrated with this power called God, it's spiritual death for me. And what that simply means is I will be blocked from the sunlight of the spirit. The old way of living, old way of thinking will be present again, and little by slowly I will find myself picking up a drink no matter how hard, no matter how much I try to think the drink through, because I have a mind that will take me back to that which is killing me, and it'll be booze. It'll show up in different sorts of sprees at first, but eventually it'll be booze. And for us, the drink is to die. It isn't only spiritual death for me. It's spiritual death for many. It's spiritual death for the people that God had me lined up to work with. The people, the students that God had me to go teach will never get that. The family, a book talks about taking this into our homes, occupations, and affairs, homes first. The homes, the family members who I had, was supposed to bring, if you will, this new spirit, this awakened spirit into their life is no longer there, and they experience that also. And if you don't think that's true, take a look at family afterwards when it says, years of living with an alcoholic will make any wife or child neurotic. The whole, neurotic, not erotic, neurotic. Make the whole family ill. The whole family is to some extent ill. So with spiritual death for many, spiritual life, when we're in the sunlight of the spirit, in spiritual life for many, not only for me because I get free of alcoholism and thinking about a drink is removed from the equation, but the people, the students that God has ready for me, I can teach. The places I'm supposed to go talk, I can go. Taking these principles into my home, occupation, and affairs, I can. And the people who show up unexpectedly for me, but God had them ready, you know, the co-workers who need help, the friend of a friend of a friend who's suffering from alcoholism, and I'm recovered, and I can go offer. Spiritual life or spiritual death. The other consideration I got to work with, I had to sit with this and get it, is that there's certain things we need to do in order to recover. But am I looking at this stuff, the inventory, the prayer, the meditation, the visiting relatives, the going to a doctor, the sitting with a new prospect, am I looking at it like I have to do this, I got to do this, I need to do this, or do I work with, I get to do this, I get to get a sponsor, I get to do inventory, I get to visit my family, I get to take the kids to soccer, I get to. Because we know what the alternative is. Laying up in some detox on a good day. And for me, I was left in the back of a hallway, June 23rd, 1988, literally dying of untreated alcoholism. If I live to be 100, I'll never be as old as the day I walked into here in 1988. There were no more bargaining chips for me. And I didn't know I was going to wind up on this path. I just knew for the first time in my life that I didn't want to die. And that's the beginning of my spiritual experience. It came in the back of a seedy, dirty hallway on the Lower East Side of Manhattan. And I made a plea to God, take me from this, I don't want to die. It's the first time in my life, and I reflected on that in here. I don't want to die. And my Heavenly Father didn't have to show up in some decorative palace or some, you know, high-end, classy AA meeting where people look good. He showed up in the back of some filthy hallway to get one of his children. And then I got put on this path. And I realized I didn't want to die, and I'll do anything not to. And then I find myself in here, get placed in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I sought this with the desperation of a drowning man. 18 years later, thank the good Lord, I still am, because I have revisited this work many times and do lots of work with 10 and 11 and work with lots of people and get lots and lots of phone calls of people I don't even sponsor, but I do my best to handle all those calls and work with those people because I know what it's like being on the other end when I call up. I'm currently working with a word called immediately in step 10. Immediately. Not hanging out with a resentment that I can't shake. Write the inventory, pray, and it's still there. Immediately discuss it with someone. And I call up, there's a few people I call up to read inventory, and they graciously listen and embrace what I got. So when the phone calls come in, I do my best to reciprocate that way, because that's how God would want it. The power comes to me and out, to me and out. When our book says we begin to sense the flow of His Spirit into us, well, what am I doing with that? I got mine, you get yours. Or they say, here, in abundance I give to you the way my Father gives to me. After I got out of my fifth treatment center, I had conceded to my innermost self, our book talks about this being the first step, conceded to my innermost self that I was an alcoholic. It didn't mean I was going to recover yet. But when I conceded, when we get to that place of submitting under pressure, when we know it's over, and we'll do anything to keep it stop. That's a spiritual event when that happens. We have, most of us, this moment of clarity where it stops. The train stops. We get clear. I don't want this anymore. And there's no reservations, any kind, no lurking notion. We're really clear on, I'll do anything to stop this. And that's what happened to me. Doesn't mean we're going to get recovered because I had two more treatment centers left in me. But I had conceded, gone into my fifth treatment center for 9 weeks and got drunk 2 days later. Hit my sixth treatment center out in a day and a half. Seventh treatment center, thank the good Lord, something happened. But after 10 days of being in my seventh treatment center, and God willing, my last one, my mind still was telling me maybe a little bit different, but Spirit kept moving me to people who had a solution, and I found myself in Minnesota. My family thought a lunacy commission should be appointed for me, like our book talks about. 5 treatment centers, 9 weeks in one of them, and you're still drunk. I thought I was hopeless. I was one of those people who were really, really beyond ill. Beyond help, beyond God. And I start to hate God because of that. What I didn't know, what I know now and come to experience, is what step one tells me. That if I'm a real alcoholic, I have no power, choice, and control to stop it. And getting angry with someone for relapsing, maybe I'm not a real alcoholic because I can't identify with that. You relapsed again? Yeah. They're probably the real alcoholic who needs a solution now, not in 90 days. Sit with them now. My sponsor sat with a guy, one more arrest, he was going to go away to jail for a very long time. Got out of jail, he was doing, what do they call that, probation, and he was looking to go drink again. And he showed up to my sponsor was in Staten Island at the time. He said, I'm in a lot of trouble. He says, I don't know what got me here, but here I am. And he was romancing, drinking, and some other substances. Well, here's what we did. My sponsor sat him down, walked him through the first three proposals. We held hands at the dirt step together. He sat down, wrote inventory, came up with seven names. I figured nowhere near enough to do this work. My sponsor said, good enough. Seven, we need power. Lack of power is our dilemma. Let's get power. We sat down. The guy did his fifth step, gave instructions to six and seven. Bang, out, making amends the next day. That fast. So the person who's relapsing regularly in AA needs to get to this work if they care to have it. Now, not next month, not make 90 meetings in 90 days, not there's a quarter, call me. Now, that's overlooked in a lot of our AA meetings. Lack of power, choice, and control, step one tells me. Step one tells me that I suffer from a phenomenon called craving, that whenever I drink alcohol, the craving's intensified, never satisfied. More was my drink, and I had no idea when that was going to stop. It stopped when it wanted to. I have a mind that will take me back to that which is killing me. It's called the obsession of the mind. It'll pretty up a junkyard to get me back to a drink. And if I'm around here a little while, it'll show up in different ways. The drink will disguise itself. If I'm untreated, they're called sprees. The sex spree, the food spree, the money spree, the anger spree, the fear spree, sprees. Because what I'm doing is trying to seek some sort of comfort somewhere. What I'm really doing is running away from the discomfort because it's on me again. And eventually, I'll have the strange mental blank spot, order a double Jack, let's get going. Right? Or a beer, whatever your thing was. And we're wondering, how did this happen? And people wonder, hey, he was sober, she was sober, this man, what happened? Real alcoholic. When I see them relapsing, like me, when I used to relapse, the real alcoholic, they need power. Step one tells me I am drinking. You know, you'll hear in contemporary AA, step one tells me I can't drink. No, step one tells us we are drinking. Not that we can't drink. Step one tells us, you are drinking. I am drinking. That's the lack of power, choice, and control in the mind before I even pick up a drink. The unmanageability as a result of drinking, a blind man can see it. No rent is being paid. The kids aren't taken care of. The family is neglected. Our lifestyle starts to resemble the drunk. Whether it's an internal condition or external condition or both, it starts to resemble a drunk. Spiritual malady. What, CNN News, half the planet suffering from a spiritual malady, right? And we have a lot of people in AA who suffer from a spiritual malady, but don't have the obsession and compulsion to drink. Have a mind that will take me back to that which is killing me. So the lack of power, choice, control is in the mind before I pick up a drink. Get out of treatment after 9 weeks, my mind said, suddenly the thought crossed my mind that I can drink, it'll be different this time. And I go with it. My current insanity is always listening to a thinking mind. I'm delusional. So step one tells me I'm drinking, and I don't know what that day is going to look like. I can't think the drink through. I ran over to page 24 because we'll hear in a lot of, especially these beginners meetings, where they tell a newcomer, think the drink through. Play the tape to the end. First of all, they forgot to tell that newcomer about something that we can experience as a real alcoholic. It's called the strange mental blank spot, which means we're just drunk. Wondering, how in God's name did this happen? At a certain point in the drinking of every alcoholic, we pass into a state where the most powerful desire to stop drinking is of absolutely no avail. The fact is that most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice in drink. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. We are unable at certain times to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. The almost certain consequences that follow taking even a glass of beer do not crowd into my mind to deter me. If these thoughts occur, they are hazy and readily supplanted. Think the drink through. Bring the body, the mind will follow. The last thing I wanted was my mind showing up anywhere. The main problem in alcohol centers in the mind, not the body. And we tell a newcomer, don't drink, go to meetings, bring the body, the mind will follow. We just gave him a death sentence. Unless we're informed and we've had an experience with this book, then we're not saying things like that. Then we're saying things, do you have a sponsor? Have you gone through the work? Where are you in inventory? Have you made a decision yet? Are you a real alcoholic? and we hopefully bait that drunk to get spiritual consent. Because I'm not one of these people. I wasn't brought up in saying, I'm your sponsor. Ask me. Give me spiritual consent. Then I can go at you. And you can't say, don't ask me those questions. Life or death. Spiritual life, spiritual death. Step one tells me I'm drinking. I have a phenomenon called craving, mental obsession, spiritual malady. If the problem is in the mind, where my book tells you, main problem for alcohol sin is in the mind, not the body, where's the solution? I raised my hand and said, well, if the problem's in the mind, that's where the solution must be. The solution is not in the mind. The solution is an awakening of the spirit. When the spiritual malady is overcome, we say, not mentally and physically. My job is to seek this power. I'm an alcoholic and cannot manage my own life. No human power can relieve me of my alcoholism, and that includes her. We hear it. I'm in this great relationship. Terrific. Everyone likes to have a great relationship. I'm thinking different. I'm feeling good. I'm going to the gym, and we have that little euphoria. And then she says, I don't like you anymore. I'm going to drink. My recovery is based on an external condition. I'm in serious trouble. And she or he is an external condition. Money is the external condition. Having page 52 in order, right, looks good for a while, but if I depend strictly on that, I'm in trouble. It's the internal remedy that works. It's called God. Step one paints me right into a corner. No human power is going to relieve me of my alcoholism. Well, that just cuts off everyone, including the AA meeting. AA means consisted of human powers. We come here. There's power in the unity of this fellowship. We feel the camaraderie when we walk into a place like this. It's band-aid on open wounds when we get here. But that itself is insufficient. We need to experience the power of God. We hear in AA, it's a we program. We admit we're powers of alcohol. It's a we program. I thought it was a spiritual program. Doesn't we imply a human power? Doesn't we imply self-reliance? Doesn't we imply me and I can't keep me sober? It's a spiritual program. With spiritual principles, not spiritual part, spiritual program. And I need to seek this. God could and would if he was sought. And we get to have an experience and it becomes God can, has, and continues to. If I seek him, we get free. We get free. And if anyone's here tonight wondering when the obsession is going to be off them, I can offer you this, that you can get free. And drinking is removed from the equation. Not like what we show up with step one with, where it's on us constantly, but we can't get away from it. We're no longer in that place of I'm drinking no matter what, unless I seek God. I had made many, many attempts to stop drinking. I had many, many powerful desires to stop drinking. And still got drunk. And in the back of a hallway in 1988, it was done. And there wasn't this much of a reservation, nothing. Everything was removed from me. Which is what the work does, by the way. It's about removal. In order to get free, it's subtraction, not addition. Back to the relationship stuff. We come in here like I did, right? And we have what we talk about, that hole in the soul, that void. I feel empty in here. Really, what's happening, we're just filled with contempt, prejudice, old belief systems, pomp, calamity. There's this wedge between us and God, if you can see it with the mind's eye, right? It's the only way I can describe it adequately. But we feel empty, and what we do, we start reaching out, get the car, get the money, get the job, get the relationship out there, external conditions, and it works for a little while, but we still feel empty and wondering why what's on us all the time. Then the car gets old, the relationship gets old, I bring my old behavior back into those affairs, and I'm wondering how come I want to blow my brains out, and I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous. In order to fill that void that we feel, we have to literally remove everything that's in there. If we have an 8-ounce glass full of water and try to fill it up, what happens? It just pours over. There's too much. That filled glass is what makes us up, and it's full of things that are killing us. We simply have to empty it out and fill it up with the Spirit of God and awake. And that's what this work does. That's why a lot of people run when they hit step four. Because the rubber hits the road. It's one of the many any lens, and we feel like we're dying when we go through this work. It's drastic and revolutionary proposals they're talking about. It's uncomfortable. A book in the 12-inch hole says, who cares to admit complete defeat? None of us. Who cares to look at manifestations of self, and I can't blame you anymore? It's necessary. It's vital. And I need to know God's showing me, God showing me, God showing me. You want to get free? Here's what's in your way. I'll help you out of the way. I'll help you get out of the way. And we have 12 proposals to get completely free of alcoholism. So I'm painted into a corner in step one. And step two offers me a solution. Came to believe that a power greater than myself will restore me to sanity, wholeness of mind. And in wholeness of mind, because of a spiritual experience, my thinking mind is no longer telling me about drinking. And if I'm waking up and I'm growing up spiritually and I'm really working with 10 and 11, even the untreated behavior is dead. I am free. Oh, I'll have to write inventory from time to time because parts of self may show up in a form of a resentment or an expectation or a fear, a little contempt once in a while. But I'm not experiencing untreated alcoholism in the form of sprees and contempt all the time, or simply living on page 52. Came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. We have an experience, we start to really believe in this power, based out of the experience we have, we seek experience. We show up to this power of God and we're wondering, you know, how do I believe? Who do I believe in? And when we start a chapter to agnostics, it blows the door wide open on any contempt that we may have when we're talking about God. What a powerful chapter of spiritual literature. Our own conception of God, no matter how inadequate, was sufficient to make the approach. And at the beginning, it could be GOD, group of drunks for good orderly direction. The bottom line here is, am I willing to go along spiritual lines or not? Am I willing? Yes or no? Circumstances in step one allowed me to be willing. So step two for me offered a solution. It was a pointer to the solution. The way all this work are pointers to God. My thinking mind, main problem for me, my thinking mind. My thinking mind will get me into trouble faster than the biggest person in this room. My thinking mind will do me in faster than the biggest, toughest guy in a bar. My thinking mind will destroy me. The only way I rely on my thinking mind is when it's completely clear of wrong motives and I'm walking on this path and I still seek counsel. My thinking mind, I use it by making plans, like getting here tonight, making plans to get here. Making arrangements to get here. I use it. My thinking mind is set aside, and my way of going through the day is relied upon God and inspiration, intuitiveness, seeking counsel. Clear the wrong motives, I can make a list, a to-do list for today. Need to do this, got to get to work, call the boss, call a client, take the kids to practice, cook dinner, you know. Our usual mundane tasks that we do sometimes, plan it out and I go. I use my thinking mind. When it's using me, I'm driving here and I'm character assassinating the guy from last week who didn't talk about the big book. Right. I'm worried about next week. I'm worried about what happened a week ago. I'm in 10 years ago. I'm in 5 years from now. Only woulda, coulda, shoulda. And that guy at the meeting and she better not start this. When I come home, with dinner ain't ready and it's just... None of it's good. Why am I driving to this meeting? Why did they ask me to speak? I got nothing to share. I should just go home. There's too much traffic. Thinking mind, thinking mind, thinking mind. That guy asked me to sponsor him. I can't stand him. Oh my God. Obsessive and compulsive thinking mind. And what the spiritual awakening allows me to do is recognize that and get free of that in here also. So step two was my solution, was appointed to the solution, and study chapter to agnostics. They beg us to lay aside prejudice, lay aside old ideas. One of the greatest prayers I've worked with is something called the lay aside prayer or set aside prayer. When I first heard that prayer, I thought I was telling God, what you gave me is not good, I want more. want something different. All we're simply doing is laying it aside. If I have a bookshelf full of books and I buy new ones, I take some down and put them to the next level and put my new books up. I'm just laying aside to make room for new experience. Lay aside prayer. God, please let me lay aside everything I think I know about the big book, the 12 steps, AA, and you, God, for an open mind, new experience. Father, please let me see my truth. Let's go. Just lay aside. No one's telling me to forget it. It didn't work. Just lay it aside. So am I willing to have God be everything? What was my choice to be here? And again, I think our book, as tough as our book can be, is very mild here. You know, they ask me, what's our choice to be? Is it really a choice? I'm faced with alcoholic destruction or finding a spiritual way of living. A spiritual way of life, and our book says, or else. I know what the or else is. I'm back in a hallway on a Lower East Side on a good day, drinking Mr. Boston Blackberry Brandy to pass out, because the pain of being awake and sober is too great. That's my or else. That's my alcoholic destruction. And we take people with us. Step three, I make a decision in three, and it's simply a decision. When I was going to meetings in Brooklyn, I would hear, do the AA waltz, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. Or do a step a year. And I don't get that. But I do get this. That I had to be willing to live life on terms other than my own, God's terms. I live life on God's terms today, not life on life's terms. I fell miserably living life on life's terms. Chaturthi Agnostic says God's terms are easy, open, all-inclusive, never exclusive. When we're in the sunlight of the Spirit, it's just kind of like, with all the challenges, with all the things our families have to go through sometimes, there's something deep down in here that we move, we move, we move. No attachments. Some requirements in step three talks about, am I convinced that my life on self-will can hardly be a success? Something to sit with, because the first answer we'll always give to the sponsors, oh, sure I am. Sit with that. Am I really convinced that my life and every area of my life can hardly be a success based on me running it? One of the assignments I got to do about the third time through the work was go through every area of my life and sit with it. Did I think I was doing a good job or not? But I think I was capable of getting past any unmanageability that I was experiencing. Was I involved in any of this stuff? And I had to search diligently, because if there was a little tug on it, that means I was holding on to a little self-reliance here. And if I'm doing that, somewhere there's fear. And there's unmanageability. And here comes page 52. And if I don't do anything about that, here comes a suddenly. Suddenly, the thought crossed my mind. A drink would be nice. We'll hear lots of times about the third step decision, about turning it over, let go, let God. How do you turn it over? And we can talk for hours and hours. And our book is so precise. Just what do we mean by that? And just what do we do? Can't get any clearer than that. And they show us, what do we mean by turn it over, Peter? And this is how we do it. There's some neat stuff on page 62 and 63, if I can find it. Great promises, third step promises. It says, this is the how and why of it. First, I had to quit playing God. Why? It didn't work. Right? Next, which means now, I decided hereafter in my drama of life, God was going to be my director. The director tells the actors what to do. Right? The director on the set is the boss. Tells the actors what to do. God is the director. He is the principal. We are his agents. I didn't know what that meant. And then I sat with my sponsor. Very simply, Michael Jordan. We all heard of Michael Jordan, right? He's the principal. He hires an agent. He gives the agent power to go out and represent him. He goes back to to Michael Jordan and says, this is what I have. And Michael says, yes to this and no to that. We represent God. We are given great power in Alcoholics Anonymous. Page 68 says that God will demonstrate through us what he can do. That's great power. Work with another drunk is great power. We go out and represent God. We're his agents. He's the boss. He's the father. We're the children. Unconditional love. Teach us and guide us. Provide us what we need all the time. I sat with that and worked with those promises. for 6 months, sat with it in meditation, read the words and sat with it. Because what it tells me on page 63, it says, when we sincerely took this position, all sorts of remarkable things followed. I had a new employer. Being all powerful, he provided what I needed if I kept close and performed his work well. It tells me, established on such a footing, I became less and less interested in me and more about what I can contribute to life. Less and less about me, more and more about you. And if you shoot over to page 62, I'm consumed with me. Selfishness and self-centeredness are the root of my troubles. It's all about me. One page over, I'm out of the way. What can I contribute to you? What can I give back to this life? Great promise. And the third step prayer is the affirmation of this decision in three. Where we simply sit with someone, whether you hold hands or get on your knees, however you do it, the intent is what counts in a third step prayer. Even the wording could be different. If I never heard his third step prayer and I'm sincerely looking to turn my will and life over to God, you think he's going to sit back and say, you missed the word, so do it again. Right? The intent is what's pure. It's what counts. My intent pure. But we have a beautiful prayer and we get to look at it, memorize it. We sit and we say our third step prayer. And then we don't hang around. Let me get my life together. I'm working my third step. How do you, without doing step four? Because it says next we launch out in the course of vigorous action. Right? Step four, personal house cleaning. And we go through people, institutions, principles, fear, sex. The principles for me became more and more current belief systems as I did this work, even belief systems I acquired in Alcoholics Anonymous. So we have this four-column inventory, resentments of all the people. And I had to pray before I wrote because whenever I didn't pray, I didn't write, or I would justify. I would conveniently forget. The sponsor doesn't need to know about that. And I start to get sick. I could feel the thing in here, this unmanageability. And I sat with my sponsor, and I'll clean up the language, but he said that you made a third-step decision to turn your will and life over to the care of God, and he's going to show you what to write. The pen is simply a spiritual translator. God is giving us the information. I need to ask him to be searching, fearless, and moral. Why? To stay away from the drink and be of service to you, and if I go help drunks, great. Primary purpose. And so I began to pray before I write and give thanks when I was done. So I don't walk around with some of the sordid spots I'm going to be visiting in step four around in the rest of my day. And I wrote down all the people. I went back through my life. I didn't care if there was a resentment at the first inventory connect with them. I just put people down. That evolved over time. And then I did my second column, why I was angry with the person in column one. I didn't write a life story. I don't like Joe. He's really a good guy when I first met him, but lately he's been really kind of funny. I always say hello to him, and we go on, this thing. And suddenly, I'm really right, and Joe's really wrong. Anger will insist that I be right. It'll insist that I be right. And when we're in a resentment, when we have that retaliation going on in the mind, I mean, if you're like me, we're beautiful. We're like Clint Eastwood in Dirty Harry. I mean, we come back with the right, comebacks. We know how to maneuver. If you want to be tough, we lay the guy out on the floor, one punch. I mean, we're just great, right? On the inside. On the outside, we say, sure, anything you want. We walk away. When we get home, I look at the third column, right? Pride. Personal relationships, self-esteem, security, pocket, ambition, sex relations. Parts of these areas of my life that are being affected. And our book says we considered it carefully. Why? Because we get to see fear a lot in the third column. Pride. No one should see me this way. No one should know this about me. Why? Because they may not like me. What does that mean? They may stay away from me. What does that mean? I may be abandoned, feel abandonment, which means I'll be alone. I'm going to die. Security, what I need to be okay. They're not giving me what I need, which means they don't respect me, which means they don't care for me, which means they're totally discounting me, which means I'm going to be alone, which means I'm going to be abandoned, which means I'm going to die. Fear in the third column. We'll get to see it. It's a precursor, sets us up for fear inventory in some cases. And I get to write the fourth column. Rubber hits the road. It's all about me here, all the manifestations of self. And then I go sit with someone in five, and I need to speed this up because we close. And...
So 1 hour and then open it up.
Okay, so we're almost on the hour, that's why. Okay.
We'll
be here next week, don't worry.
It'll be good.
Thank you. Fourth column talks about my part, where I was at fault. And it's the first time for me that I could not blame you, even though you may have done some unkind things to me. Even though you have gone out of your way to hurt me. And for some of us, like me, maybe when we were little children, we were bothered by adults in a way that was completely inappropriate. With me? How do I write down a fourth column? You ripped me, you robbed money from me. An adult who did something that was improper with me. Right? You went out of your way to harm me in another way. How am I at fault in the fourth column? I have to disregard what you did, regardless of what it is, entirely. It's one of the many any length our book talks about. And rubber certainly hits the road. And I've experienced all of those sort of resentments. And every one of those areas showed up in my fourth column. And I remember calling my sponsor saying, hey, I was 8 years old. 9 years old and 10 years old. I was a little guy. And I was scared to death, and it made me feel dirty for the rest of my life on the inside. I felt less than a man. I felt inadequate because of what they did with me. And my book is telling me to put down where I'm at fault. And my sponsor, bless him, he said, Peter, how long have you been hating this man? And I'll call my old sponsor, I'll call him Bill. I said, Bill, my whole life. In fact, and I kind of got a little animated. I says, I'm strong enough now and big enough now that if I had him in a corner, I'd look to do some damage. That, he said, has to go. The hate in your heart has to go. Don't need to love this man. Certainly don't need to have a relationship with him. Just stop the hate. It's what's blocking you from getting to the next place. Now, rubber hit the road, and it was a lot of work behind that. A lot of prayer. And a lot of seeking some outside help. I got so free of that, I've been in that guy's company a couple of times. And I didn't pick up a chair and break it over his back. You know, like my Clint Eastwood thing had going on. Little John Wayne-ism going on. No, get in there. None of it. I got free of that to talk about it to you, and I pray I'm not being distasteful in sharing that with you. Okay. And I share that because over the years, women have come to me and shared that type of pain, but the guys never. Can't. I'm a guy. And I ante that up, and little by slowly over the years, men have come to me and says, I never even told my sponsor that. Can I talk to you about that? We need to talk about that. Or the people who physically hurt me for no reason. I'm at fault where? Hating them. Vengeful. Spiteful. Character assassinating. I had to get past that stuff. It was one of my many any lengths. And trust me, it was one of my many any lengths. But little by slowly, I start to get free of that because we're talking about God taking one of his children from point A to point B. What I have to remember here, what I ask you to consider when you're writing inventory is no matter what goes on paper, no matter what sort of sordid spot we get to visit or what shows up, right, what sort of resentment, whatever it may be, it's coming from a loving God. The work we get to put on step four is coming from God. God is saying, here, this is what's in your way of getting free. I'm not doing this on my own. The Spirit's moving me. The pen is the translator and it comes out. And if you've done inventory, you know when you're writing, all of a sudden things start showing up that you just, where's this coming from? Right? It's God. So our inventory, when we follow directions, and please, the St. Lip Service, I offer this to especially someone who's never done inventory. If we follow directions, we have a sponsor, and we pray, the fourth step is, in a sense, perfect. You know, we hear this, I've got to write the perfect fourth step. You can't write a perfect fourth step. We can if we turn to God. In spirit, in essence, the fourth step is perfect because we're following directions and God is giving us the information. So therefore, it is perfect because God is not imperfect. So those things that I care to forget about when I'm writing, oh my God, I can't believe I'm reliving this. Go through it. God will move you through it. It's what's in the way. The obstacles in my path, the obstacles in your path, whatever they may be. Park Avenue, park bench, I don't care. Don't compare. Whatever in the way. God's giving it to us. We suit up and show up. I'll do anything, sponsor any lens. Turn my will and life over to care of God. And God says, okay, your life is truly mine, and I'm going to show you how to experience all of me. My God doesn't hold back and say, I'm going to give you a whole lot of work and watch you do before you can experience my love. We're the people who were blocked. We created this. I created my own calamity. I created my own dramas, my own contempt. And God's saying, here's the sledgehammer, get it out of the way. And he allows us to do that. And we really, you know, may you find him now. We don't have to look too far because the great reality is deep down within, right here. Thumbprint of God on all of us. The spirit of God in every one of us. Back to resentments. The great reality is deep down within. God's in you, God's in you, God's in you, God's in you. I'm angry with you, I'm blocked. 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 Times that by 200 or 300 people. So my first inventory looked like. I made 200 direct approaches, and that's just where my story took me. I had 5 books of like spiral notebooks. My sponsor almost bailed on me when I showed up. resentment after resentment and fears. Fears. Unbelievable fears. And God says we can get free. And then it tells me in step 4 that we're prepared to look at it from an entirely different angle. And it holds the key to my future. Prepare to look at it, my life, this work, from an entirely different angle for the first time ever. There's a shift in consciousness. Because they have some thoughts that promises. There's a shift that happens within while we're doing the writing. And some of us are not even aware of it, but it starts to happen. When we get to see ourselves on paper. Excuse me. Thank you. It's kind of like walking down a Manhattan street, trying to go from Madison Square Garden up to Times Square on a day like today. You're trying to, you know, weave in and out. But if we go up to a building, up to the 10th floor, we look at it from an entirely different angle. We see a path. The newscopters are up there for a reason. They can see clearer. It's a different angle than the guy driving in the car. God allows us to have a shift to look at our life from a different angle and get to see our part. Get to see how we started the ball rolling. Get to see how unforgiving we have become. Get to see how we're so attached to a resentment or a fear or a part of our life for drama that it becomes our life. We get attached to drama. This false sense of self, this is my life, this is my drama, I'll create more drama, I'll look for drama. So I go into a meeting and say, there's Joe with the drama. Because without the drama, I feel like I cease to be. And I get to see all of that. You'll see it even in our meetings, the person who's always in drama and looking for new drama. Because they think that's who they are. They think that's who they be in here. It's delusional, but I was like that too. Step 4 allows me to see that. The false sense of self. The me that's run by a thinking mind and all the drama that creates. My attachments to my external condition, thinking that was a remedy for what ails me on the inside called alcoholism. Got to see all of that. Wrote out a fear inventory. It would be fears like I had up until I was about 15, fear of firemen. And there's simple fears like that. The firemen used to roll down the block or go put out a fire, and I couldn't understand why I was 15. Maybe even 16. And had this this feeling in me that was like I was scared. Couldn't identify it. What was going on with that? Wrote out some inventory. When I was a little boy, I remember living in Red Hook, Brooklyn. I remember my mom would give me the little bottle, and I'd lay in bed, and the fire trucks would roll down Van Brunt Street, Red Hook, Brooklyn, almost every night. And there was a famous poster that was out of this fireman, this rough-looking fireman, having this little baby. He was taking him out of a burning building down a ladder. My head told me, the firemen are going to take me away from mom and dad. He got internalized. 16, I'm still afraid of firemen. I'm writing out inventory, fears come up. Where is this coming from? I got to see that from a totally different angle. Simple fears like that. I got to see other fears. I got to see how much my fear was attached to because I was in self-reliance. I got to see fears of dying, fears of no money, fear of poor health, fear of money, fear of good health, fear of never dying. My sponsor had me do the opposite. Great assignment. Fear of being old and poor. Okay. Most of us would raise our hand. Okay, write this inventory. Fear of being rich and growing very old. Fear of being rich and never dying. Let's play that. Let's play with that. What's that look like? Why would there be fear? This fear, because self is in the way. Who wants my money? How do I protect my money? I'll be around forever. What does that mean? All the people I know are going to be passed on. I'll be alone, abandoned. I'm going to die anyway. Got to do the opposites with fear. We got to institutions. The first time I went through to work, the medical community and the religious community were on top of the list because both didn't save my mom who died from this. My resentment inventory, by the way, had I was told to write down me and God. I found a whole lot of things to be angry with me about, but I didn't think I could really be angry with God and or tell anyone about it, but I put down God because he didn't save mom either. And I blame God for everything. And as one of my teachers says, I've been going through life treating God like a person and people like God. Had it backwards. You know what I mean by that? I go to Joe and say, Joe, I need this done, okay? And I expect Joe to follow through and dot every line, cross every T and do it perfect. He's human. He makes a mistake and I'm writing pages of inventory on him. I'm not going to turn to God. It's not going to work anyway. Got it backwards. I treat God like the person, like fallible, and the person like God, infallible. I got to see the difference between friends and acquaintances. If we had coffee together, you were my lifelong buddy. Right? And I wondered why you weren't around all the time. That was a hard one for me to swallow, the difference between friends and acquaintances. And principles were a lot of belief systems I grew up with. And I sat with my first sponsor, and we went through this work, and my first sponsor embraced everything I said. He didn't judge me once. He looked bored a few times also. And he gave me some insight. And remember when I called up my sponsor about this incident that happened to me as a young boy, and I said, they want me to write down where I was at fault. You know what he told me when we sat with my fifth step? That the same thing happened to him. And I felt no longer alone. Another man experienced this and had the same repercussions from it. My lungs were filling up with air again. It was called God. Since then, going through the work, I've been able to work with what I call multiple fifth steps. Our book talks about personal persons. And I sit with other people besides my sponsor. And trust me, where our book says we may have had spiritual beliefs, we now begin to have a spiritual experience. And it happened to me every time. Not necessarily when I got done with five, but somewhere between five and nine. Step five, with my current sponsor, sitting with more than one person, personal persons. And the first time I went through to work, it was just the sponsor and moved on to six and seven. And since then, I found out, and I can talk to you about this from experience, that the more people who are on this path that I get to share with, the freer I get. Who understand what I'm about to do, understand it's a life and death errand, will embrace what I have to share, and give me guidance and feedback, and make things that much clearer, and kill ego, kill self some more. Pages 23 to 43 make me a seeker of God, and they still do. And if this is one of the any lengths I need to go through, it's sitting with more than one person, then so be it. And I got to see in sitting down every time with my fifth step, and even more have a profound impact on me in the latter times I've gone through the work, is how I was playing God when I wrote, when I was writing out my fourth step. And going over my life, I saw how I was playing God, how I had my plans and designs for everyone else, how I assigned roles for you, for me, and for God. No wonder why I was in so much fear. I got to see all of that on paper. I got to see everything I don't want to be. Do I want to still walk with this into the rest of this journey? No. It made my six-step consideration that much easier to make, to say yes to. All my belief systems about God, I got to see knowing God by not knowing. I got to unravel a lot of my belief systems about God. God is this, God is that. My idea of God, my concepts of God were just that. Concepts, very little experience with God, if any at all. And they, my concepts about God came from a thinking mind. A limited thinking mind. I can be the most worldly man in the world, on the planet. The most read university scholar. And yet my mind, whatever comes up with about God, amounts to a grain of sand on the beach. Because we're talking about infinite power. And all my plans and designs, all my decisions, everything having to do with God were based on what I can see. Like if I step outside of this meeting hall and I look down the block, I'll probably be able to see for about a few blocks. And that's it. Look behind me, the same thing. To my left and right, the same thing. Can't see any further. And I've gone through my life based on that limited sight distance. And I've interpreted everyone based on limited sight distance. Limited whatever I had in me. Limited. Limited insight. Limited intuitiveness. And I did the same exact thing with God. And my book dissolves all of that. Because God is everything. And if God is everything, then maybe God is nothing also. Before there was everything, there was nothing, but there was this power. And it was there before my heart took its first beat, and it'll be there long after my heart takes its last beat. It's present. Power. All love, no opposite. And I had to see that, and I got to see that, and how I got to see that was by sitting with someone in five and sharing what I had just wrote. What I had written. And then great things started to happen because I would get some feedback and some guidance and be steered a little bit clearer in a better direction. And then I would ask questions. We ask questions. And if my sponsor didn't have the answer, he would send me to someone who was better equipped to answer. There's great learning and great experience in asking questions. Because if we don't ask questions even about God, then we become fanatics. And we see what's happening on the planet because of things like that, right? We ask questions. Ask questions. Sit with the sponsor. What does this mean? Great students ask questions. Great teachers are students also and seek counsel. How neat would it be if you could imagine this about asking questions? If whatever your God looked like, if there is a look, whatever your power is that you pray to, showed up and sat down next to you, would you hesitate to ask it, her, him questions? You may confess how much you love them, how grateful you are. And then you would be a student saying, what does this mean? How come this? We would ask, it would just come out of us, the questions we would have to ask. Here we are. The greatest spiritual teachers I've found in my life have been members of Alcoholics Anonymous, recovered members. Why do I hesitate to ask questions? Ask questions. We have some fifth step promises our book talks about. And I didn't experience those fifth step promises the first time, right after I got done with the fifth step. I was more relieved that it was done. I did feel something that another person knew all about me. And there was some, the mind had some disturbance, but here it felt very light, very open, very, very roomy, very free. I didn't have to worry about what if they find out. How much I angry with that or fearful about that or something I did. You know, read sex inventory to another guy. You know, about those things that we rather just not let anyone know about. Certain behaviors. Right? Someone knew me. And those fifth step promises, I remember starting to experience something. I didn't wake up until I was in 6, 7, 8, 9. And I remember being at a meeting in Brooklyn, and I was in, got my instructions 6 and 7. I was creating this list for 8, and something was going on that I could not describe. And when I can't describe something that feels so blissful and so joyful, it's God. I remember sitting with another member that my sponsor sponsored also at the time, and I'm sharing with this person what's going on with me. And they were just delighted for me because they knew what was going on. Since then, I've sat with a prospect, and then the sponsor, another AA member, and then the sponsor, and shared my fifth step. It has evolved this way. I don't have that many names on like I did the first time. Although one time I went to sit down and figure this is going to be a snap inventory. There'll be about 10 names, and 70 names showed up. My current inventories are just that, current inventories. When I revisit the work. However, sometimes old resentments still show up. Things from the past still show up. And I put them down anyway. But my focus is on current stuff. And how I knew I was starting to have a shift, an internal shift within me was this way. I go into the work, and it was the third time maybe, and a friend of mine from California called me up and he said, "Hey, how's that inventory going?" And he had this snicker about him, this way of laughing, very cynical. And he laughed and says, "How's that sex inventory going?" Right? And at that moment, I knew something changed. Because the first time I wrote inventory, my sex inventory looked like a newcomer's sex inventory. Everything you would expect was in there. Right? But this time, a few years removed from the first time, it had little to do or nothing to do with sex. It had to do with my ideas of how men ought to be and how women ought to be, belief systems about our journey. Thinking we were, well, there's an obvious difference, but thinking we were different in spirit. And I'm John Wayne. And you're the fair maiden, you know. Waiting for me to come home. And real men do this. You know, I grew up in a family full of longshoremen from downtown Brooklyn. And real men throw punches first and worry about it later. Anything less than that, you're less than. Now, we've changed, thank God. My dad, being watching me do this and my brothers seek that path, he's kind of like softened up a bit. But growing up, it was you throw punches first, worry about it later. Anything less than that, I was less than. And women are supposed to be this way. And I was having trouble with personal relationships. I wonder why. Right. And I got to see that stuff, and I realized how much God allowed me to get moved past the stuff that plagued me on the way in. The great change that happened for me. My whole life was full of infidelity with girlfriends and things like that. And meeting the same type of woman. Wondering why they hate me and I hate them. But then something happened where I've been in a very long-term relationship when I was married. And even after that dissolved and I'm in a new relationship where I'm honest. Which is very unlike how I used to be. And I'm just so grateful for that. Because what I found out also by going through this work is my harsh treatment towards women. And God has allowed me to treat women like children of God, not like as women, and I'm the man. To seek counsel with women And I have to get a woman's perspective to see what how they approach this. There's a few women in Jersey who are just great teachers to me. And I woke up to that because I had to share something in my first fifth step, and I really dislike men who do this, but there was an incident. I came out of a blackout in downtown Brooklyn on the F train, Smith and 9th Street, if any of you guys know that. It's a big train station, beating up a girlfriend, ripping her purse out of her and hitting her because I wanted money that she had and wouldn't give to me. Came out of a blackout in that condition. I don't know what happened to her. I don't know where I was before that, but I came out of this blackout in that condition, and she was in tears, crying, and people, you know, just keep walking by because they don't want to get involved. I hated me for doing something, turning into an animal that I turned into. And alcoholism had a big grin on his face because it had two, not one now, in its grip. And that was painful for me to read in my fifth step. What my Heavenly Father has allowed me to do is, I don't do that. I've never done that since. And I treat women with respect. I don't 13-step women. I see vulnerability when they walk in here and I direct them towards women. It's the least I can do. And try to be a teacher or a friend or a big brother to some. But not manipulate and deceive. Because my spiritual life depends on that. It's how God allows me to do it. And I'm not making a sacrifice when I do that. With me? It's who I be. And I share that not to think highly of me, but the greatness of God. Step 6, after finishing step 5, it says, if we can answer to our own satisfaction, looking at, are the stones properly in place? They ask us some questions on the bottom of page, I think it's 75. Have we tried to really sneak something through the archway? Have we tried to get something past God that we think he's not going to find out? Have we omitted anything for building an archway through which we shall walk a free man at last? I thought I was free in the past. Now tell me, at last, you're really going to be free. Is our work solid so far? Are the stones properly in place? Have I skipped on the cement put into the foundation? Have we tried to make mortar without sand? And it says, if I can answer these questions to my own satisfaction, I look at step 6. We're building this archway. I was a longshoreman, a union guy for 23 years. And I know how union guys perform. Shortcut, let's get out of here. Coffee break. That's a generalization, not all union guys. I did. Right? I'm not getting paid, the hell with the archway. Right? I don't want that archway. So God's showing me what to do, and really, God is the one who's building it. Using me, building it. Using a sponsor, building it. God's doing it. It'll stand forever. I'm going to pass through this archway free. I look at these questions, and if you break it down, they're asking, have we tried to sneak something by? Have we kept something that no one's going to find out about? That sex inventory, that fear inventory, that thing that I thought was insignificant, I feel like an idiot for sharing this. Have we anteed up? And if we have, then there's a shift that is a great promise. Book says, doesn't to your sponsor satisfaction, not to the group satisfaction, if we can answer to our own satisfaction, we've had a shift go on here. Power, the lack of power we had, now we're getting some power, and we're using that power. Okay, can I answer these questions to my own satisfaction? Truthfully, yes. Look at step 6. Am I ready to have God take every one of these things? And I consider, am I ready to have God take them all? He better. Because if I don't turn to God and have him work in those defects and deal with them, they will deal with me. And very often what happens is what gets in the way is the way. This work, we look at it like, what an order, I can't go through with it. The same thing with God. How do I get to God? Oh my God, that's too much for me. What gets in the way is the way. But when we start to unlearn, we get free. When we start to subtract and reduce things, take things away, we start to get free. And we get to see that we are beyond form, beyond name. That we're really truly, and this has been a new thing for me. I've heard a million times, but a new meaning for me, new depth, that we're truly spiritual beings having this human experience. Beyond name, beyond form, beyond content. Same thing with God. Just is spiritual being moving from moment to moment to moment to moment. Free or in the grip of alcoholism? We look at step 7. The prayer has very little to do with me. The prayer has a whole lot about me being of service to God and others. And I ask God for strength to go out from here, right here, to do His bidding. Steps 8 and 9, into the world of the Spirit. Go work with others. The second time I went through the work, it became my first step for life. Because what I was looking at was the manifestations of self, the defects of character that was still there, that had to go, and if they didn't, they were going to kill me. It was my first step for life. And I suit up with a spirit of willingness to have God remove these things. One of the assignments I worked with the first time was I listed the defects that were revealed to me and listed the opposites of those defects on another sheet of paper. Dishonest, honest. Self-serving, giving. Hateful, loving. And I turned back to God for this stuff. I go through the work the second time with the 7th step, and I do the 7th step prayer, and I remember feeling completely empty on the inside, like I'd never been to an AA meeting in my life. Like I never opened up the big book. I was vibrating on the inside. I was scared to death. There was no thinking about a drink, which is key to this experience, because I found out later on it was truly a God experience. And I was feeling so shaky, like I was dying. I prayed again and went to a meditation after the 7-step prayer. And I sat in meditation. The word that came to me was, Father, save me from me. Which is what I talked about a little bit earlier. Father, save me from me, because I will do me and faster than anyone. And then I called up my sponsor. He says, Mark, here's what's going on. And he says, sounds like you're having an experience to me. Thanks a lot. There was something that took place this particular day. It was a Sunday. And every fiber of my being wanted to put my hand on the wall and go with old way of doing things, old belief systems. I'm going to get in there. I'm going to go fix it. Get in there, go fix it. Got to get in there, go fix it, because it's going to turn out this way. And I couldn't. I couldn't. And I wanted to all day. I was on this obsession. I got to do something. I should make this call. I should go do this. I should make this call. I got to do something. And I couldn't. Well, the end of the day happened. And I promise you, it worked out perfect, divinely perfect. And then I was so grateful that I didn't create another new drama by doing what I wanted to do. Common sense truly became uncommon sense. One of my teachers says, my answers for today are tomorrow's problems. Right? Shit. What I found out, that experience I was having the second time through the work, I was truly experiencing the emptying out, the death of self. And it feels like we're dying sometimes when we go through the work, because we're dying the death of self before the physical death. And that's what was happening to me. I got to challenge everything, and it was incredibly uncomfortable in here. But then I got free. And that emptiness started to get still. And the mind started to get still. And then I got present and mindful and back to breath. My 8-step list, which came out of step 4. And I start making amends. I've gone through this work many, many, many times. It feels so wonderful on the other side, not always when we're going through it. So why deny my spirit in me and others? I get a chance to help the greatness of God and the greatness of this power. All the work we do in here, our point is to the glory of God. We ought to be an AA, a pep rally for the power of God. We should be shouting from the rooftops about what God can do for us. A pep rally for the power of God. And too many times in contemporary AA meetings, don't talk about God because you're scared a newcomer out. Tough. If they're lucky, booze may kick him back in. If it doesn't kill him, it's like getting wheeled into an emergency room with a life-threatening wound, and the doctor says, easy does it. What are we demanding? We're demanding help now. Stop the bleeding. I don't want to die. Help me. Well, what happens when the drunk walks in with one day? state of obsession dying, and they show up to us. You know, the last place they're going to walk into, but here they are. And we tell them easy does it, but we don't give them a solution. Or the gentleman or the woman who walks in here with 25 years or 20 years or 15 years or 10 years and is dying to think about drinking and suicide and just too afraid to tell anyone because we may think less of them in their thinking mind, and they're thinking about blowing their brains out. They don't know what to do, and we say, well, they got 10 or 15 years. They got it together. Really, how do we know? Or when we tell the newcomer, instead of, I'll sit down and work with you, once they ask us to sponsor them, or we offer this book to them before they ask us to sponsor them and say, we have a solution for you, you never have to drink again. We tell them, make 90 meetings, that we hear, but some meetings, make 90 meetings in 90 days, right? And my book tells me we have to quit playing God because it doesn't work. Aren't I playing God when I tell a newcomer who's in a state of obsession, who keeps relapsing, who can't stop drinking, make 90 meetings in 90 days, like I know they're going to make 90 meetings in 90 days without picking up a drink. If they had the power to do that, what the hell are they doing here? But I play God by saying, Joe, you can't stop drinking, so make 90 meetings in 90 days, make more coffee. He or she is trying to hold on to another hour. Their life is in the toilet. They're dying. Maybe they just got out of another treatment center, and we tell them, just put the plug in the jug. That may work for some. And if it works for you and you're here tonight, bless you. I'm not trying to tell you you're wrong. What I am going to do is challenge it for a real alcoholic. Because I got that information and almost died. And the people who showed this book to me annoyed me. They disturbed me on the question of alcoholism. And I'll close with the story on how it happened. God separates me June 23rd, 1988, December 22nd, 1988. I want to drink more than anything in the world. Everything's caving in on me. I'm acting like a drunk without a drink in me. And if she only loved me again, if only this happened, when that works out, I'm living in Minnesota. There's 30 feet of snow out. I can't take it. I'm driving down, I don't know, wherever it was, somewhere in Minneapolis or Bloomington, and I said to myself, the first bar I go to or the first crew on the corner who's dealing something, I'm getting fired up because this is awful. And then something came over me in here. I says, God, I'm in trouble. Just help me. I don't know what to do here. I thought of this gentleman in Minnesota. Called him up. He was my first sponsor. Kind of like the first sponsor. Went to his house. I shared my dramas of life with him. He says, Peter, where are you with God in the 12 steps? I said, Joe, when do you start the steps? And he says, when you stop throwing up, you're late. He disturbed me on a question of alcoholism. But he offered me truth. So I won't lie to a drunk, and I hope you don't lie to me. And I'm very grateful to give this message away with the same love and gratitude that it's given to me each and every day, for fun and for free. That's all I got. Thanks.
And as most of you know, we've been doing a workshop with Peter M. and Chris S. Over the last few weeks, and they've been doing a rotation. Doing a couple steps and switching and doing a couple steps. And tonight, I'd like to present Peter M.
You can clap. My name is Peter. I'm a recovered alcoholic. I'm grateful to be alive and sober and at a sacred place called Alcoholics Anonymous. First things first, again, thank the group for inviting me back and allowing me to be here the last few weeks and share my experience with this work, my experiences with a power greater than myself called God, my experience working with others, my experience being a recovered member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank all of you for being here the last few weeks and giving me the permission to share what I'm inspired to share. Thank Bill and Dave and for being here each week and doing what they do. God separated me from alcohol June 23rd, 1988. I'm a recovered alcoholic, and anything less than that would be falsely humble in telling you if I wasn't. A power greater myself took me in 1988, separated me from alcohol, and put me on a path in Alcoholics Anonymous. And then teachers were put in my path, and I sought them out with the desperation of a drowning man the way I seek this work today. And little by slowly, the dots were connected for me when I didn't have the power to connect them. And then God gave me power to connect the dots. And I get to a place called recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. Contrary to what we'll hear in contemporary AA, where we're always recovering, we'll always be thinking about a drink. It's normal to think about a drink because you're an alcoholic. And I challenge that all the time because my book gives me different information and my experience proves that. And my experience, not only mine, but countless others, that we'll get to a place called recovered. We go through this work, hopefully without any attachments, real attachments to what it's going to look like when we're on the other side, what my spiritual awakening is going to look like, how I'm going to feel, how I'm going to be, who I'm going to be when I get to the other side of the archway, when I walk into the world of the Spirit and experience all of God, prior to that or when I get there. And so we go through this work, the drastic and revolutionary proposals that we'll go through and get to experience. And what I have found out for me, and I speak for myself, that the work will take me to experiencing God. And once I get to that place, entering the world of the Spirit, my book tells me I've become recovered. With the problem called alcohol has been removed, and I get to a place where the isms can get removed also. They dissolve. They fall away. The more God, the less self, the freer I am. And so we get to experience God. But what my experience has shown me over and over and over again, if I'm experiencing God, I'm experiencing presence, mindful of the moment. Moment to moment, what I'm really experiencing is silence. And what my book has allowed me to do is take me to God, which is really, my book is taking me to a place of silence. Silence in meditation, and silence amid all the noise that goes on. The traffic, the people talking, the supermarket, the children, the family, there's silence that underlies all of this. It's called God. And if I can get to experience that, I get freer. Even if I'm feeling free, I can get freer. Can I listen to the silence between the words someone speaks? Can I listen to the silence among all the noise? Because the silence is what is always present. The noise interrupts the silence, whether it be the mental noise or the external noises, the internal dialogue or the external noises. This book has taken me to a place of silence. Silence when I'm speaking now, deep down within here, that we can get inspiration that comes to us rather than from us. I'm no longer plagued by voices of the past. I can be present and be moved by this power. Silence, mindfulness, breath. Which brings me to a place of not being attached to before, and how it should have looked, and what they should have done, and what they should have said, or later on, what they should do, what they should say, how it ought to be. I quit playing God. I know this power I have found out by going through this work, by not knowing, by not trying to interpret, by not trying to conceptualize. It's beyond thought, beyond form, just like we are, just like I am, beyond thought, beyond form, beyond name. It is. Can I experience that by just doing this work? Absolutely. Can I read other inspirational books and be quick to see where religious people are right? Absolutely. That sixth sense our 10-step talks about. Silence. Hear it? If I can take that into all my moments, I experience an awful lot of freedom. Contrary to the way it was when I walked in here in 1988, where I looked for noise, I looked for drama. It gave me something. It gave my thinking mind something to do. My mind is constantly saying, give me something. make more drama. Give me drama. No drama, I'll make some drama. I'll create drama. It gives me something to do, something for my mind to think about. This way I don't have to be present and deal with me. And some of us in here are always looking for drama, attached to drama, controversy, problems, never accepting what is. And what this book does, take me to God, and I go past that. And the more I'm in an experience with God, the more in the sunlight of the Spirit I am, the less I'm in trouble because I'm out of the way. Oh, I'm here, I'm present physically, but all the manifestations of self, the thinking mind is removed. Pride and ego is set aside. I'm present. And I'm not trying to figure out what to tell you while you're asking me a question. I can listen. And it becomes so much easier to say, I don't know. Rather than I got to come up with something because they may think less of me. All that stuff's removed. That's why I love to practice the silence in meditation. That's why I love to write inventory when I have to. I get to do this stuff. I think I shared a couple of weeks ago, instead of having to, I got to, I need to, I get to come to this meeting. I get to write inventory. I get to pray. I get to meditate. I get to recover. I get to experience God. I get to go to a doctor. I get to play with the children. I get to take the wife here. I get to. The alternative is no choice. And do whatever drink tells me to do. So I had to unlearn a whole lot of things while I was in here. Some of those things were just removed, but there was a lot of unlearning. Finding out what God was not in order to experience what God is at that moment. Presence. So I came into Alcoholics Anonymous with all these belief systems and a lot of contempt about anything to do with God. Spirituality and religion to me was synonymous. I found out that the spiritual path can take me to a religious place, a religious community, but there's a little bit of a difference between the two for me. So when you talk about a spiritual way of living, I heard you say a religious way of living, and I had contemporary investigation. And I would bristle at antagonism. And I came in with belief systems and resentments and fear about God. What that looked like for me. Main problem for alcoholic centers in the mind, not the body, right? The book tells us, how often do we approach God with a thinking mind and use our thinking mind to figure out what God is and make decisions based on a thinking mind? Well, God, my mind says God is this, so that's God, and so therefore I just limited God, put him or it or her in a box because I'm using me to figure out God, to interpret God. And I could be the most well-read man in the world. I can be a scholar from university. I could have the secrets of the universe. And it amounts to a grain of sand on a beach when it comes to me figuring out what God is and its power. It just is, all love, no opposite. So how often do we go through our day and figure out how God is? I know God based on my thinking mind. I've shared this a million times. I can see to the end of this room. If I go out on the road, probably see a couple of blocks, and then I lose it. Can't see any further. Behind me, to the left of me, to the right of me, in front of me. And I make all my decisions based on that limited sight distance. I make all my decisions based on everything I can hear. And God is way beyond that. God is much greater than that. I've learned the hard way. When things don't work the way I think they ought to, maybe it's God saying, this is not good for you. I need you to be here. I need to steer you in this direction. I'm back to acceptance of what is. And the difference between the happiness that we always shoot for and the internal peace that we can get in here. The happiness, got to get the money, got to get her, got to get the right house, got to get all the external things so I feel happy for this long. I bought the new car. I feel happy. Then I get the first car payment. I'm angry again. Then I'm really, it's bondage. Where do I park? Don't hit me. Pull into the driveway. Keep the kids away. I'm standing outside with a shotgun. Great way to live, right? And then the car gets old. And I start throwing cigarettes and cans, and I don't care anymore. I stop washing it. That kind of fizzled out. and I'm looking for something else. Internal happiness is a different place, a state of being, how I be, regardless of what I'm driving, what I'm making, who's in my life, who's not in my life, because the mind's not involved in that. Mind always trying to interpret good, bad, like, dislike, all of it. Able to see me over the last 18 years, how many times I fell into thinking mind and freedom with spirit. And I share that with you because my book has pointed me to that place and pointed me to other directions in order to experience freedom. And every time we show up to this work, we may be experiencing being free. The question we sit with is, do I want to get freer? And if the experience of going through the work on the other side of the archway was so glorious, felt so good, I'm shouting it to everyone. You know, I'm in amends, I'm feeling good, I'm writing inventory, I'm feeling great, everything seems to be okay. I have a different presence I feel in here. Then why deny myself to go through that once more? And what happens is somewhere in 10 and 11, we start to kick back and use sound bites from the past in order to be, you know, to use for present stuff. When I went through the work, when I had my spiritual experience, all this leads me up to now, what are we doing currently? What's my current prayer life look like? What's my current life of meditation look like? Where am I in amends? Who am I working with? Do I have any of those things going on? And if we don't listen to the mind, who's going to start to judge and character assassinate you and not allow you to be impeccable with your word towards yourself. Just recognize it as, okay, I just woke up to something. I need to do more. I need to experience more. Maybe I should experience more. I just woke up to some walls that I've been hitting. So we get to experience the death of self before the physical death when we go through this work. I shared, I think, the first week, how many of us come to this work to die? And when I was given that question, I was annoyed. I was insulted by a question like that. What do you mean I came here to die? I turned into Pete from Brooklyn in about 2 minutes. What do you mean? But we show up to the sponsor's doorstep, right? Can you help me? Why? Because it's on us and we got to get past what's on us. I can't stop thinking about a drink. My behavior looks like a drunk without a drink in me. Fear is on me. I'm living on page 52. Or we show up to the work after being in here a little while, and we seek these big book workshops, or we seek out a teacher. Take me past where I am. If we look at that, what we want to do is die. We want to experience the death of self, because that's what's in the way. When we work with meditation, we can experience a place. My sponsor's teacher called it nothingness. People call it pure consciousness. Space. There's nothing going on. There's no mind going on. It's pure. It's freeing. It's presence. We can work with meditation and get there. Unlike what it was for me when I got here. We can get to that place and take that experience into all our affairs. Now my thinking mind will tell me you can't do that. I have to go to work. I need to think. I need to send the children off to school. I need to think. I need to go argue with my neighbor because he has the lawnmower going on a Sunday morning at 9 o'clock. I need to think. But can we take that place that we get to in meditation into those affairs? So we practice meditation by silence. In silence we meditate. Meditate, we silence. We get silent. In silence we meditate. Step 10 says on page 84, this thought, the thought they're talking about is what precedes that, is that these promises will always materialize if we work for them. With that thought, it brings us to step 10, which suggests we continue to take personal inventory in continue to set right any new mistakes as we go along. Inventory and amends is what step 10 involves. As we clean up the past, and it uses the word, this way of living, and how it works, it says, we develop a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. Way of living, developing a manner of living. It's not something that I go to, like, I'm in trouble, got to read my book. I'm going to get free and wait till it's on me again. I need to call the sponsor. It's now who we be, a new place of consciousness or awareness. It's who we be now. This is what we do. This is who we be. Inventory, seek counsel, make amends, meditate, work with others, give of myself without expecting anything to in return, a completely new set of ideas we're guided by now. We're God-inspired rather than self-inspired. It says I've entered the world of the spirit, but it doesn't mean I get free room and board. Like, I had my spiritual awakening, so now I'm going to hang out for a while and see what happens. Because alcoholism knows exactly what I'm doing, right? As long as I'm in the sunlight of the spirit, the problem has been removed and will stay removed. When I start to rest on my laurels, my accomplishments of an hour ago or last week or last month, alcoholism says, maybe we do have a crack in the armor. And the red flag is what I was alluding to earlier when I use my experience of yesterday, my spiritual awakenings of yesterday, to use for today, rather than going through the work again. I had a spiritual experience back in, 1975, and it's 2006, and I'm still replaying that. And is it possible I've started to worship my mind and intellect and knowledge rather than God, which has been keeping me sober all along? So every time we get to go through this work, we smash ego, we kill self a little bit more. Less self, more God. It says, my next function is to grow in understanding and effectiveness. My book uses words like vigorously, next, now, launched. Words that tell me, convey a thought that I need to do something, need to move. It says, this is not an overnight matter. It should continue for a lifetime. Continue to watch. And it gives me some things to look out for. Watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. When these crop up, I ask God at once to remove them. I discuss them with someone immediately and make amends if I've harmed anyone. I've been working now for a while with this word called immediately. There's three guys I speak to. When something comes up, I'll write inventory, make prayer, and if it's still with me, I'll discuss it with someone immediately. I won't give it an opportunity to grow and carry into tonight. Carry into tomorrow, then we get the emotional hangover. You know how it goes when you wake up first thing in the morning and you're in yesterday and you got the internal dialogue going on, we're maybe seeking counsel. Hey, I can't get past this. This happened an hour ago. I'm with it. And so we seek counsel, discuss it with someone immediately. And then I go see who I can be service to. And I've shared this many times. I was working for this day trading firm, and I was an HR person, and I went from the waterfront to white collar, and that was just, it was very strange for me. I had to learn how to write emails and wear a shirt and tie to work, and just that whole corporate thing that goes on, right? And there was a gentleman there who reminded me every day that he went to a university, and I didn't. And he made it really clear that he was here and I was there, and I was intimidated and fearful by the guy, and I had lots of internal dialogue about ways I can more than just character assassinate him. Are you with me? And then he would talk to me, and I would be fearful of coming up with a good idea to go recruit in Ivy League schools, which was part of my job, and it got me. And I had a lot of ugly language in my spirit about this guy, and I called up my sponsor and he said, well, what's the inventory on it? And I had to write some new inventory and discuss it with him right away. And then I made some prayer. Well, here's what happened. The guy's in my path at work, and I'm looking for drama, and it wasn't there. I was looking to get angry. I was looking for something so I can now get him. And it was all removed, and I was able to stand shoulder to shoulder with this guy. And here was the knee thing. I was able to sit with this guy and figure out a game plan on the next business trips that we had to these different schools and get these kids interested in our company. Without being gun shy, without being intimidated, without being better than, just shoulder to shoulder. And I was looking for drama, and I couldn't get it. There was a gentleman I worked with when I was on the waterfront, and he did some really unkind things to my dad. Really unkind things. Not with his hands, but with his mouth. And my dad was about to experience some really severe consequences because of what this person did. And so I was on a mission. John Wayne, that character, was in full, you know, flight. And I was going to track this guy down and show him what I thought of him, right? But my sponsor, very wise man, had me write inventory on this guy. And all the fear and all the anger, all of it. And I'm working with inventory. And I'm working with a lot of prayer and meditation. Father, fill my heart with a spirit of forgiveness. They only know what they know. Great words, the carpenter says, forgive them, for they know not what they do. Can I work with that? Well, I'm going to pick up a dear friend of mine. We're on our way to a meeting, and I get lost. I'm in Staten Island. I get lost. And I turned down this block, and I see someone jogging, and I thought it was one of us. I said, I know that guy. He's in the rooms. And it wasn't. It was this guy. We'll call him Bill. And I looked at him. I swear, nothing. And I'm trying to replay the old stuff so I can do John Wayne with this guy. Jump out of the car. Tony Soprano. Jump out of the car. Do all of that, right? Which, if you know me, I'm not a fighter anyway. But my mind says, yeah, you can go fight. I'm looking for something. Replaying the stuff he did, there was nothing. Absolutely nothing. And he just jogged right past me. For a moment, I was frustrated. I couldn't get angry. And then I realized how free I was, because that was something that was a thorn in my side for the longest time. And I could not get angry. I was free. And I went to pick up my friend Tom. We went over to the Way Out group and had a great meeting. When I got home that night, I called up my sponsor. He says, here's the experience I had a few hours ago. And his question to me was, well, why did you doubt God in the first place? See, we take this booze problem to God, take this from me, because you're the only one who's going to take this from me, but the rest of my life, I can probably manage. And we treat, as one of my teachers says, we treat God like a person and person like God. Turn to my buddy and say, listen, you need to do this for me. And I expect that he's going to do it absolutely perfect, divinely perfect, without missing a beat. And I put all the shovel expectations into this guy's lap, and he or she falls short. And I'm angry. Didn't you listen to what I said? Weren't you paying attention? Right? We do that to our spouse all the time, right? But I go to God, and, well, he ain't going to pay attention to this. I don't have expectation that God's going to fix this. I got it backwards. My perceptions were backwards. And here was the perfect incident that I got past. It says on the bottom of page 84, I've ceased fighting anything or anyone, even alcohol. Am I currently, in my mind, my internal dialogue, am I fighting with anyone, even though they're not here? What's that look like when I'm all alone? How am I doing with that? By this time, sanity will have returned. Back in step 2, we return into this power to restore us to sanity. In step 10, they deliver the contract. Here it is. You're restored to sanity now. Wholeness of mind. You're not thinking about drinking, are you? You're free. Just what we promise you. Just what God said I'm going to deliver, He delivers. For some of us, we experience it before we even get to 10, before we get to enter the world of the Spirit. But by 10, we've got it, assuming we have followed directions. Can I take my fear there? Can I take my sex life there, my relationship life there, my diet and health to this power? Can he take me past where I currently am to a better place? Do I think that this is it, got free from alcohol, and the rest I'm stuck with? Or do I think on my own power I'm going to get past that stuff? Or am I willing to take everything to God? My sex life, my relationships, my money, my job, my health, everything. It says, for by this time Samuel will have returned. We will seldom be interested in liquor. If tempted, we recoil from it as from a hot flame. We react sanely and normally, and we find that this has happened automatically. I don't have to will myself into this. It's done for me. Can I say that about other areas of my life where I may be experiencing some trouble? The sprees that we may get. By following this work, can I say that about other areas where am I trying to get me past my bedevilments if I'm experiencing any of them? We will soon see that a new attitude towards liquor has been given us without any thought or effort on our part. It just comes. That is the miracle of it. We're not fighting it, neither are we avoiding temptation. It says, we've been placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. The problem does not exist. It's been removed. We are now recovered. At this place, we get recovered. How's that looking for me? Inventory. Seems to be two schools of thought. One is you don't write out inventory with regards to step 10. Others you do. I was brought up with writing. The only difference is I was passed something on. Something was passed on to me. I got attached to writing a lot. A lot. It got me free, and I continue to write. But what was presented to me was what our book, Big Book, says, that a business which takes no regular inventory usually goes broke. But a business which is always taking inventory will go broke too, because they never open for business. And I've seen people in here who claim to be on this path with their lips who are in the book. Constantly got to go through new drama, more inventory, new drama. Give me drama so I can write more inventory. And never being open, and the experience that they have, go share and go work with others. And God will say, okay, time to go through the work again, but they're always in there. I attend a Big Book meeting somewhere. And there's a lot of people who are on this path, but three-quarters of the room is attached to drama, is in drama, reworking, more inventory, more, which is a neat thing, but no one's getting free. They're attached to the methodology. They're attached to the mechanics. They're attached to the writing, and they don't have time to get out there and get free or experience the freedom. So this was a great lesson for me. But my the way I work, my 10-step is when something shows up about with a resentment or a fear or something that my mind has me thinking about tomorrow, next week, I'll write it. Resentment shows up, I'll make prayer, still there, I write, discuss it with someone, and then I work with immediately if it's not going. What about the job interview next week, the wedding next week? The doctor's appointment tomorrow, and I got that thing going on, job interview. My sponsor said it best, need a job, got to get a job, need a job, got to get a job. Oh, no, they called me for a job, you know, it's they want to hire me now. It's constantly going on. What the mind says is impossible, the spirit always proves to be possible, and I forget that. So what about that stuff that I'm looking at? Do I need to show up in a job interview a wreck and full of self-reliance? Or the job interview next week, which is troubling me tonight, Tuesday, I can get home and write some fear inventory on what's going on with me. Discuss it with someone. And go to that interview with God. And go to that doctor's appointment with God. Go to that wedding where Uncle Joe is going to be drinking again with God. And I can be there when I get there. I can be present. It says it's easy to leap on a spiritual program of action and rest on my accomplishments. I'm headed for trouble if I do, for alcohol is a subtle foe, subtle, sly, clever, devious, and difficult to detect, and a foe is my personal enemy. That's what I'm up against. I'm not cured of alcoholism. What I have is a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of my spiritual condition. Every day is a day I must carry the vision of God's will into all my activities. How does that look for me? Am I carrying a vision? Am I willing to carry the vision of God's will into all my activities? Even though the vision of God's will is contrary to my will. I was sharing with someone yesterday. You know, how do you know the difference between my will and God's will? Well, I know what God's will isn't, and that starts to clear up the picture a little bit, right? But, you know, you're sitting down, you're looking through the meeting book, and there's that fancy meeting in some nice town where everyone shows up on Saturday looking good. They smell great. Everyone's going out after the meeting. Not too much work. It's a social event. We all have one of those meetings we've attended from time to time, right? It's a nice place to go to. I want to go there. And suddenly, Spirit says, no, you need to go down to the Bowery, where it doesn't look so nice. It doesn't smell so nice. But I need you to do service down there. And suddenly, we're stuck as what's God's will for me tonight. Carrying a vision of God's will into all my activities means taking some action. I can go to that meeting any time, but tonight I'm being moved to go down there. And contrary to what I want to do, God's got me going here, so I go. And it's always great when I get there. God's will for me, my experience has proven, is fulfilling. I'm full when I'm done. When I'm done with my will, I have guilt, remorse, uncertainty, insecurity, the wrestling, the internal dialogue, the woulda, coulda, shoulda. God's will, I go, and I'm full. How many meetings do we go to, and the topic is, experientially, tonight we're going to talk about what it's like carrying a vision of God's will to all activities. That's what you'll hear. And they won't invite you back. What's that look like for us? How can I best serve thee? Thy will, not mine, be done. These are thoughts which must go with me constantly. Am I doing this? Is my life a walking meditation? We can exercise our willpower along this line all we wish. It's the proper use of the will. The bottom of the next paragraph says, we've begun to develop this vital sixth sense, but we must go further. And that means more action. So again, my book is telling me to move, and we're developing this vital sixth sense, one beyond what we came here with. We don't need to acquire anything. We don't need to get anything. We get to do things. I don't need to acquire anything. Because all we've been given, all we need for this journey, we were given when we showed up. Not in Alcoholics Anonymous, when we showed up here. Everything we need. A great teacher in my life sat me down and says, this work takes you home. We go home with this work. Everything you need for this journey, you've been given. You don't need to acquire stuff. What you need to do is lose stuff. The subtraction, not addition, in order to wake up. The less self, the more God. The removal of contempt, prejudices, pride, ego, all manifestations of self. And what we get is home. And that's where we have everything we need to go out. If for anything like me, when I first showed up, I talked about that hole in the soul, the void that a lot of us have. And I thought I was empty. I was full of me. And all the stuff that I acquired, the pomp, the calamity, the worship of other things, fill in the blank, I had it and it was not working. It was not working for me. And it all had to go. Removal. That's why the work for some of us is painful, uncomfortable, drastic and revolutionary proposal. Who cares to admit complete defeat, not only in one, but looking at self and say, this is what I've accomplished. I don't want to be this anymore. It's got to go. I don't need to acquire anything. I just need to get rid of stuff and God will do it. So I show up to the work willing and let the work take me. So I work with inventory throughout the day. I'll write 4-column inventory. I'll discuss it. Those are the mechanics, the resentment, the cause, what it affects in me, my part, where I was at fault. Write the fear inventory. And then I move. Step 11. It talks about evening and what to do during the day. They ask us some questions for an evening review. My current practice is when I wake up, I'll work with prayer, I'll work with meditation. In the afternoon, I work with the religious practice for the longest time now. And that's just my thing. I was moved to work in this religious practice, and that's what I've been working with. And after I get done with this prayer and this practice, I go silent. And in the evening, I do the same, prayer and meditation. I got attached to reading a lot of these books that we have out there, all neat books. But I had to read this book, and I had to read that. But, oh, no, I got to read this book. If you ask me what I read, I don't know. I couldn't wait to turn the page to get it out of the way. That was a red flag. No need to read. That was becoming God rather than God. So what I've learned is when I'm inspired to read, I read. When I'm not, I don't. I'm worshiping God, not the book, not even this big book. In the evening, what I do, I mean, if I retire and it's 8 o'clock and I'm in for the night, I'll write review. If it's 11 o'clock, I'll write review. If I missed anything during the day because I get the opportunity to write during the day, anything's lingering in the evening, I'll just put it on paper. Rather than waking up on Tuesday with Monday night stuff. You know, like today's answers are tomorrow's problems. We don't want that. It's all right review. In the day, it talks about we consider our plans for the day. It says, on awakening, let us think about the 24 hours ahead. I consider my plans for the day. Before I begin, I ask God to direct my thinking that it's divorced from self-pity, dishonest, and self-seeking motives. There's the doing in the 11th step, to work, shopping, pick up the kids, the doing we do, the tasks we do throughout the day. One of the things I need to consider is what kind of spirit am I taking into those affairs? How do I be when I'm going to work? Is God directing my thinking? Am I being moved by God or moved by me? How does that look when I'm stuck in traffic on the Garden State and I got to be there at 7 o'clock and it's 10:02 and I know I'm going to be late? When there's a big line at the shopping store and I need to get out in a hurry. How do I be in all those affairs? The first time I meditated, I sat with a non-AA member who showed me some great techniques. And she literally put me on this timer for 2 minutes. Be still for 2 minutes. It was about 6 months. I was in Attica State Prison for 2 minutes. I mean, I couldn't wait for it to get over. My mind was all over the place. 2 minutes still not doing anything was unbearable. But I was willing, and I worked with that. And then it became 3 minutes, and then it became 5 minutes, and I'm working, and suddenly the timer was removed. And I got to get silent. I got to get still, at the very least still. I heard a gentleman say, you know, we'll spend an hour and a half figuring out the suit, shirt, tie, the shoes match with the belt, everything's good, hair's good. It takes 2 hours, 5 seconds. Hi, God, gotta go. And we wonder why we're in collision with everything, because I'm running the show. So I make the practice. I dedicate the time. I give that time the worship it deserves, early in the morning. In the evening, in the middle of the day. The meditation has evolved for me, and I have been quick to see where religious people are right and make use of what they offer. And one of the things that really moved me there was 9/11. I had to seek out, I was forced almost to go seek out religious people and make use of what they had to offer because my back was against the wall and I was doubting all over the place. There was something underneath that, something way underneath that, that said everything's okay, pray for all, but I need to be quick to see religious people right, and the benefits for me were great, so I continue to do it, not resting on my laurels with that. Reading inspirational books, not to gain knowledge. So my ego gets stroked. And I come back to home group and throw out some pearls of wisdom, fix my collar and walk out like I'm a guru. That is the happiness. The quick fix. I read to experience. I read to be with the books. So I wake up. and I've read many books. I've been working with something it's a few years now, by the guidance of my sponsor, this thing called intent, the power of intent. And turning to this power, to see things materialize in my life, if they're according to God's will for me, not petitioning God, just see it happening. And for me, it started with physical health. I was talking about God, talking about prayer and meditation, and go out to the parking lot and be out of breath. I couldn't button my pants. I was feeling sluggish. I was out of shape. But claiming God. And that got painful. I bottomed out. And I wanted to go take care of myself. I just lacked the power. And I started working with this and see it happening. See it manifesting. From the unmanifested to the manifest. See it happening. Turn into this power. Meditating with it. As I did say with the sacraments of penance, work with that. And then I found myself on a treadmill. And then I found myself careful of what I was eating. And then joining a health club. And that's been a few years. And I take care of this gift God gave me. Practice of no name in meditation. Tremendous practice, scared the hell out of me when I first did it. The dramas I was talking about earlier. My name, Peter Marinelli, means something to me. All the things that have made me where I am. All the drama, all the challenges, all the disappointments, and the ringleader is my thinking mind that tells Peter Marinelli can do this, cannot do a lot. Attachments. You say Peter Marinelli, I get a vision of what I cannot do. And the judge in my mind tells me, you can't do this. And that's how I go about my business. I need something to make me who I think I am. There's someone who calls a false sense of self. This is who makes me, Peter Marinelli. And just let's keep adding to that so I can feel like me. Sure, nothing ever works out for me. I'll never get that job because I'm Peter Marinelli. I'll never be rich because I'm Peter Marinelli. You'll think bad thing because I'm Peter Marinelli. Can't do what those people do because I'm Peter Marinelli. I mean, what's in a name? Aren't we beyond name? And we literally can be called numbers. Does it make a difference? What is it for? Identification. When I yell out Joe, Joe turns around. That's how I know Joe. Unless you're in Brooklyn, you yell out Anthony, 55 guys turn around in the same room, but that's a whole other thing. About 20 Anthonys in my family. I think they would change a little bit, right? So I was told to sit in this meditation and remove the name. Spirit. Just spirit. No name. It was uncomfortable. No name. Just spirit. It gave depth and weight to what I've heard for years in here, that we're spiritual beings have a human experience. I don't have to say, okay, God, whenever you're ready for me, I'm going. God saying, let's go, and I go with God. That practice showed up in my life by me getting to do things and having the power and the courage to do things that would never have been possible for me. And more importantly, being freer. The work we get to do in here with the disciplines in 10, 11 are way beyond this meeting, way beyond the book, way beyond Alcoholics Anonymous, way beyond any religious community we belong to, because the point is to experiencing the glory of God. Tremendous stuff. And yet we'll go to contemporary AA meetings and we'll hear, all I have to do today is not drink and I'm a winner. Just put the plug in a jug. You didn't drink today, you're a winner. Great. Let me bring love there, even if there's no love in that room. Let me bring love, I'll experience love. Let me bring love to those people too, rather than character assassinate them. I'll challenge what they do, but I won't character assassinate them. But that information shortchanges what we can get to do in here. I don't think I talked about drinking more than a couple of times tonight. And when we're awake, we're not talking about drinking. Oh, we'll use it to talk to a new person or to remember our experiences, but we're talking about growing up spiritually. Step 12. Page 89 says, practical experience shows that nothing will so much ensure immunity from drinking as intensive work with alcoholics, other alcoholics. Tremendous promises, a promise, immunity from drinking with intensive work with other drunks. Not like, here's my number, give me a call. Sitting down with somebody and moving them through the book. However God inspires, move the book, whether it's line by line, paragraph, bullet the book, you sit down and work with another drunk intensely and watch them wake up. We carry this message to other alcoholics. We can help when no one else can. We can secure their confidence when others fail. I remember to myself, they are very ill. Has my life taken on new meaning? Have I watched other people recover and watched them help others? Have I seen loneliness vanish? Have I seen a fellowship group around them and me? Is it one of the bright spots in my life working with other people? Even the prospect who's really challenging you. We got to really work with. One of the neatest things I've experienced in here is you get that person where the light in the eyes is out. They're at the bitter end, and they show, whether it's after treatment or coming back to AA, and even the person who's been around here for a long time and has just got untreated and thinking about drinking or taking their life, right? And you begin to work with them. This is the great power we get, that we're no longer powerless in Alcoholics Anonymous. We get to work with those people, and they start to wake up. And then you walk into home group 20 minutes early, and they're up on the stage or in the corner in the car, and they're sitting with a prospect. Call me when you want a drink. They're working with others. And then that prospect is working with others. I belonged to a group called the Way Out Group for a few years in Staten Island. It was a bright spot, one of the bright spots in my life. It was just such a neat place to be. And one of the neatest things about the group was I would get there always about an hour early. I just liked being around the place. And out in the park benches that we had there, there'll be two people here, two people there, a couple people there, sitting in the car, walking to the meeting room, a couple people in chair, up in the library, a couple of people sitting there. There are people working all over the place with each other. And then we go into the meeting and just share our experiences on recovering. What a place to be. How often we walk into our home group and, you know, we have the mindless chatter that goes on. Did you watch the game? How's the weather? And but that's all we discuss. Never, how's it going for you? How's practice going? How's meditation? How you doing with amends? You know, where are you right now in the work? I walk into some groups. We'll gossip about the whole planet. Let's be spiritual now. I only have a few minutes. Part of step 12 is about, you know, carrying this message to other alcoholics. And in that is what a home group is doing. Is my home group carrying the great fact or not? What am I doing as a sponsor? Am I endorsing someone's delusional mind, or am I, you know, pulling the covers when I need to? Am I passing on the message in this book, my experience from this book, or not? Because for me, and my experience has shown me over and over again, if I look at a group that's getting sick, I go to the elder statesman if they have any. If someone is in a meeting and is around here for a while and they're untreated, I don't go to them, I go to the sponsor. Sick prospect, probably a sick sponsor. Sick sponsor, certainly a sick prospect. We can't transmit something we haven't got, our book says. And we will what we do, and sometimes that's untreated alcoholism. Tremendous responsibility we have in passing this message on. How am I doing? How's my group doing? And am I taking this message to the choir all the time? Or am I taking this message to the meeting on the Bowery, where I may experience a lot of resistance in those contemporary AA meetings, or go down to the Bowery where it's rough going, or pass the message on and maybe plant the seed and someone will get free and live. The 12-step calls, I've done a lot of them. They got ugly. They were easy. But it's where God moved me and gave me the power to move through. But I always share about what I feel is the perfect 12-step call. Out of A Vision for You, and then it talks again about it in Bill Dotson's story. Lots of times in Alcoholics Anonymous, we're worried about offending the new drunk. Don't talk about God, you may scare him out. Be careful, he's new. Watch his feelings or her feelings. Don't, you know, give them the truth, and we'll lie to a drunk. Let's talk about your issues today, Joe. Let's talk about your feelings and your dysfunctional family. You know what? Let's talk about all your enablers. And we get more angry then than before we showed up, right? Here's what Bill and Bob do. Bill Dotson's laying in a hospital. And they go up there. It says on page 156, very bottom, here was a prospect, all right, Bill Dotson. By the description, not too promising. The use of spiritual principles in such cases was not so well understood as it is now. One of the friends said, put him in a private room, we'll be down. And he says, when they walk in, who are you fellows? Why this private room? I was always in a ward before. And the way this was explained to me, when you went from the ward to a private room, it usually meant you were in serious trouble. So he's laying in his private room saying, I did it this time. I'm probably going to die. And I got these two strangers walking into my room. Right? Said one of the visitors, we're giving you treatment for alcoholism. They didn't say we want to know about your dysfunctional family and your childhood. We're going to treat you for alcoholism. That's why they're there. And in doing so, they'll save themselves, right? It says, hopelessness was written large on a man's face as he replied, that's no use. Nothing's going to fix me. I'm a goner. The last three times I got drunk on the way home. It says in the next paragraph, for an hour, the two friends, the two AA guys, told them of their drinking experiences. They anteed up for identification. They baited them. This is our drinking story. They didn't go in with a holier than thou. They got down to where the guy is, spoke his language. What happens? Over and over, Bill Dotson, the alcoholic number three, says, that's me, I drink like that. Identification, one drunk with another. He understood their stories. He understood where they had been. The man on the bed was told of the acute poisoning from which he suffered and how it deteriorates the body. They talked about the body. And how it warps his mind. There was much talk about the mental state preceding the first drink. They ante up. They tell the guy about the physical part. They tell the guy about the mental part. They don't hold back. They give him what he's up against. He said, that's me. The very image. He says, you fellows know your stuff all right, but I don't see what good it'll do. At this, a couple of sentences, at this, both the visitors burst into a laugh. It says, the two friends spoke of their spiritual experience and told them about the course of action they carried out. They ante up for the guy, they tell their story. They give him the body stuff, they give him the mind stuff, then they talk about the spiritual and talk about God. And what's even better than that, the course of action they took to get there. They laid out what they did. You know what happened to this guy? After about 3 days, he considered some things that God would be able to help him. He never drank again. Bang, bang. Next, let's go get someone else. Rather than wasting time on the stuff we hear in a lot of contemporary AA middle of the road stuff. Problem, solution. Do you want it? We can help. Here's what we did. Let's pull you ashore. Just hold on. What we get to do in AA. Resurrected. Reborn. And God gives the power to do this. My greatest spiritual teachers have been members, recovered members of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's all I got. Thanks.
Alan, alcoholic. Thanks for sharing, Peter. I wanted to ask you, the last paragraph on page 159, going into the next paragraph on 160, I wanted to get your take on that, because it talks about the beginning members and how there was three of them, and they worked diligently for a year and a half, and after a year and a half, there was another seven, so there was 10. And then it talks about what type of meetings they had, and it said they met every night in a casual get together, and then they set aside one meeting a week where the beginner or the newcomer could bring their problems. I just wanted to get what's your take on that? I mean, I don't what are they talking about?
My take on what?
On what are they talking about in there? Like, in where the beginner can or the newcomer can bring his problems. I mean, you speak about about how contemporary AA, about how it's you go there and it's group therapy or whatever. I'm not sure exactly what they meant in there. Is it when they say to bring their problems, are they talking about the alcoholic problem? Or I mean, I don't know the history of AA as much as you guys do. Are they talking about you can actually, the beginners actually go there and talk about what's going on in their life, their problems? You know what I'm saying? I mean, because it took them a year and a half to get 10 people, so obviously they weren't getting many people to follow them around, and there wasn't much group therapy going on, because otherwise they would have had a ton of people. But
a lot of what was going on was going to work with others. They were doing work, having an experience, and immediately going to work with others. And they couldn't make 90 meetings in 90 days because it says they went to a meeting a week, and what the neat part was, the family was welcome to those places. And they brought everything there, and they would meet. After the meeting, the families would get together. We, and back home in Brooklyn, we have coffee breaks in the middle of the meeting. But we get up now and go for coffee. That stuff was set aside after the meeting was over. So it was about what we can do to help others. And our friend who's passed on shared a lot of that stuff with me as to what they did in those places. When I talk about the contemporary AA, I'm talking about sitting down at a meeting and hearing someone say, just put the plug in a jug, make 90 meetings in 90 days, don't drink and go to meetings, play sober softball, the steps will get you, do a step a year. They weren't talking about that stuff. I can come to you and say, hey, Al, this is my drama right now. And you were not going to tell me back then, double up on your meetings, Pete. Okay, we're going to work you through this. God's the solution. We're going to help you get past this. But right, what we're going to be doing all the time is working with other drunks. See the difference between the two. How many meetings do we go into? And, okay, anyone want to start off with a topic tonight? My cat died. 30 people take an hour on that pet's dying. And the new person sitting in the back, the first meeting, is wondering, this is AA? Rather than let's take that cat stuff, and it's painful, we'll go to the diner with that later. Let's talk about how we recovered from alcoholism. You're having trouble, financial troubles, you're having relationship troubles. We'll share experience on how we got past that. God being the solution. Okay. Make it look clearer. Mm-hmm. Right here.
Hey, Pete. Thanks for coming down these past couple weeks. Could you give some a little more specifics on the meditation? Maybe just some things you do, or maybe some other things your other people do. As far as sitting down, how do you sit down? Do you sit on a couch? Do you lie down? Do you stand up? Practically, what do you do? When you wake up an hour early, I pray, and I'm not a very good meditator. Never been. I could use it. So maybe expand a little more on, practically. What do you do?
first things first. What I was talking about earlier, the no-name stuff, if you heard what you just said, gave you a meditation tape? Okay. That answers that question. You said something that's really neat, though. I have never been able to meditate. I have never been a meditator. That go back to the no-name stuff. Your name, you, can't do that. That's what you're saying. I've never been able to do it, therefore I can't do it. So I'm probably never going to grow in this area. There are lots of books out there, lots of CDs out there on how to do this, from trying it for the first time to as we evolve with this. But to answer part of your question, because we don't have enough time, and we can talk about this afterwards, posture and breath. Some of us sit. Some of us sit in a chair or get in a posture on a meditation mat. Posture and breath. The two things that I was told from the very beginning. You'll see a meeting. Okay, we're going to have 3 minutes of meditation before the meeting. We can. Or lean over, posture, and breath. And it isn't because God's saying, hey, Joe, your posture is wrong, so therefore you're not going to experience me. It's for us. Posture and breath. And we can, breathing. Every book I've studied with meditation talked about breath. Now, maybe there's books out there that don't talk about breath, but I haven't gotten to one yet. Every book I've read talks about breath. I saw a gentleman who has a jillion books, one of my heroes, and I got to see him in person. And he had all his students out on stage, and about 500 people did this like 40-minute meditation and this chanting. And he begins to speak. And I'm waiting for these glorious words about he's going to give me the secret to meditation that no one else knows. You know what he talked about? Over and over and over. Breath. I was floored. Breath.
I was just wondering, your spiritual experience, was it incremental or was it a sudden?
Great question. A book says sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. To build W experience or the educational variety over time. Here's what I found out. The best answer to that question. When God shows up, and it's profound, it's sudden, it's revolutionizing. We may get it spoon-fed to us. But when we finally wake up that something's different, it feels profound. So there were people looking at me saying, you've changed. You're changing. You don't see it, and I didn't. And then one day, it blasted upon me that my whole life was different, my whole thinking was different, and it was completely uplifting. When God shows up, God shows up. I have to say from an intellectual place that it was probably over time. But I don't like to say that because I just woke up to it and that's how my mind reflects upon it. If I think back to things that happened to me, they were all profound moments. For example, I was in a halfway house in Hastings, Minnesota. The town population was me and a cow, basically. That was it. And I'm in serious trouble. And they told me to pray. And I'm praying like the desperate for drowning man. And I'm just, God, please, I don't want to go back to where I just left off. I'm just squeezing hands together, please. I have one pair of pants and a shirt to my life and an old pair of sneakers that were given to me. And I'm living in this halfway house. And it was a Saturday, not yet noon. I can't go on. I've shared this maybe 3 times in my life. There was some guys outside playing basketball. And I finished praying. And I'm talking desperate prayer. Please don't take me back to what I just left off. I'll do anything. Keep me clean and sober. And I sat on the edge of the bed. And then something happened. I didn't know it until it was over. But there was something that went on within me that I can't describe. But it was the most comfort or bliss. I don't know if it lasted for a minute or an hour. I have no idea. What I do remember is two things. I looked around the room and it looked different, like as if I wasn't in the same room for a brief moment. The guys who were playing basketball, they were really loud. They were right below my window. When I was done with that experience, I realized I didn't hear them. When I got out of that place, they were going again. I heard them, and I says, I didn't hear them. It was an incredible thing that went on within me. And it was one of the first tastes of, I think I'm going to be okay. I couldn't describe it at the time. I know what it is now. But I could not say, wow, I just had a God experience. Let me go to home group and share. It was too great to even share. It was too pure to take away in a sharing. Maybe that's why I've only shared this a couple of times in my whole sober life. So we can say little by slowly, but when we get that stuff, something happens. And what came out of that was that first little thing of, I think I'm going to be okay. And I couldn't describe that. Okay.
So. I have this bad tendency of waiting. I'm Susan, I'm an alcoholic. This bad tendency of waiting until my life gets chaotic, of getting back to doing the right things and getting back into order. I get real lazy in between. It's a pattern. I've been sober a few 24s, but I don't want to drink, and God's been really good to me. But a lot of difficult things have been going on financially with work and contract. The contract crashed and I don't have a job. And a lot of the things you just said, I was like, oh man, God equals silence and get out of my own brain. But I guess my question is, how do you stay? I repeatedly, Peter, I've known you since Staten Island when I got sober. And I repeatedly hear you stay on the path. And I want to know how you stay so diligent in the times when it's easy, you know, you get caught up in the job and everything seems to be going good and I'm starting to pay the bills off. And, you know, I recently made a huge move from the West Coast and I'm starting to go, whoa, you know, and it all kind of crashed through last week. And I'm back to the basics, but that's where I seem to go. And God always seems to be there. And I'm sure he's there in between, but, you know, I'm probably not giving back. And I guess I want to know how do you stay so diligent, and level and balance? I have a problem with balance.
First things first, I've taken no credit for anything good in my life. I'll take full responsibility for anything I screw up and fall short. I got real clear of myself. I am nothing, the Father doeth the works. I got real clear on that. I got real clear on what happens to me when I move away from this. I got really clear on that. And I got really clear on praying for willingness to do this work. You've heard me share it a million times from doing these type of deals. I prayed for willingness as I did at the very beginning, 18 years later. I turned to my Heavenly Father. Thank you for the willingness to continue doing this work. Because based on me, I'm resting on my laurels and a prey to my external conditions. I feel good. My life is manageable. I'm good. Don't need to continually seek this. 23 to 43, those pages got me real clear on I need to be a seeker of God or I'll experience the or else they talk about. And I only got clear on that, not because it's a, you know, the special club that some of us get to visit. I got real clear on that because my life was so much in the toilet when I got here, and my first 6 months in Alcoholics Anonymous, and my bottoming out from time to time. I've argued with God. I've bargained with God over the last 18 years. I try to manipulate God like I was a God stronger than God. But I got real clear on those three things. Of myself, I am nothing. The Father doeth the works. I show up to the altar like a willing student. You point me. I'm real clear what happens to me when I point me. Well, I'm working with, I started to get into my current practice. I got away from it. One of the things I'm praying for, not only to do this work, but I'm working with four words, purity, honesty, unselfishness, and love. Tall order. I'm working with that. I see little things manifesting from time to time that is not of me. Mm-hmm. Okay, we're out of time. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.